Again, neither of them considered that someone trying to spray paint a message while at the same time maintaining his balance on a set of crutches might not be able to manage much in the way of neatness. The message read, "Fuck Johnson, killer president, U.S. out of Vietnam now." It was flanked by a couple of peace signs. I've read that some criminals, perhaps a great many criminals, actually want to be caught. I think that was the case with Stoke Jones. Whatever he had come to the University of Maine looking for, he wasn't finding it. I believe he decided it was time to leave, and if he was going, he would make the grandest gesture a guy on crutches could manage before he did. Tom Huckabee told dozens of kids about what was spray-painted on our dorm. So did Becca O'Bear. One of the people she told was Franklin's second-floor proctor, a skinny, self-righteous girl named Marjorie Stuttenheimer. Marjorie became quite a figure on campus by 1969 as founder and president of Christians for College America. The CCA supported the war in Vietnam, and at their booth in the Memorial Union sold the little lapel flag pins which Richard Nixon made so popular. I was scheduled to work Thursday lunch at the Palace on the Plains, and while I might cut classes, it never crossed my mind to cut my job. I wasn't made that way. I gave my seat in the lounge to Tony DeLuca and started over to Holyoke at about 11 o'clock to do my dishly duty. I saw a fairly large group of students gathered in the snow, looking at something on the north side of my dorm. I walked over, read the message, and knew at once who'd put it there. On Bennett Road, a blue University of Maine sedan and one of the university's two police cars were drawn up by the path leading to Chamberlain's side door. Margie Stuttenheimer was there, part of a little group that consisted of four campus cops, the dean of men, and Charles Ebersole, the university's disciplinary officer. There were perhaps 50 people in the crowd when I joined it at the rear. In the 5 minutes I stood there rubbernecking, it swelled to 75. By the time I finished wipe-down shutdown at 1:15 and headed back to Chamberlain, there were probably 200 people gawping in little clusters. I suppose it's hard to believe now that any graffiti could have such a draw, especially on a shitty day like that one, but we are talking about a far different world, one where no magazine in America, except very occasionally Popular Photography, would show a nude so nude that the subject's pubic hair was on view, where no newspaper would dare so much as a whisper about any political figure's sex life. This was before Atlantis sank. This was long ago and far away, in a world where at least one comedian was jailed for uttering fuck in public, and another observed that on the Ed Sullivan Show you could prick your finger but not finger your prick. It was a world where some words were still shocking. Yes, we knew fuck. Of course we did. We said fuck all the time. Fuck you. Fuck your dog. Go take a flying fuck at a rolling donut. Fuck a duck. Hey, go fuck your sister. The rest of us did. But there, written in black letters 5 feet high, were the words, "Fuck Johnson. Fuck the President of the United States." And "Killer President." Someone had called the President of the United States of America a murderer. We couldn't believe it. When I came back from Holyoke, the other campus police car had arrived, and there were six campus cops, almost the whole damn force, I calculated, trying to put up a big rectangle of yellow canvas over the message. The crowd muttered, then started booing. The cops looked at them, annoyed. One shouted for them to break it up. Go on, they all had places to go. That might have been true, but apparently most of them liked it right there because the crowd didn't thin out much. The cop holding the far left end of the canvas drop cloth slipped in the snow and nearly fell. A few onlookers applauded. The cop who had slipped looked toward the sound with an expression of blackest hate momentarily congesting his face, and for me, that's when things really started to change, when the generations really started to gap. The cop who'd slipped turned away and began to struggle with the piece of canvas again. In the end, they settled for covering the first peace sign and the fuck of Fuck Johnson. And once the really bad word was hidden, the crowd did begin to break up. The snow was changing to sleet, and standing around had become uncomfortable. "Better not let the cops see the back of your jacket," Skip said, and I looked around. He was standing beside me in a hooded sweatshirt, his hands plunged deep into the pouch in front. His breath came out of his mouth in frozen plumes. His eyes never left the campus cops and the part of the message which still remained. "Johnson, killer president, out of Vietnam now. They'll think you did it. Or me." Smiling a little, Skip turned around. On the back of his sweatshirt, drawn in bright red ink, was another of those sparrow tracks. "Jesus," I said. "When did you do that?" "This morning," he said. "I saw Nate's." He shrugged. "It was just too cool not to copy." "They won't think it was us. Not for a minute." "No, I suppose not." The only question was why they weren't questioning Stoke already. Not that they'd have to ask many questions to get the truth out of him. But if Ebersole, the disciplinary officer, and Gerritsen, the dean of men, weren't talking to him, it was only because they hadn't yet talked to... "Where's Deary?" I asked. "Do you know?" The sleet was falling hard now, rattling through the trees and pinging every inch of exposed skin. "The young and heroic Mr. Dearborn is out sanding sidewalks and paths with a dozen or so of his rotsy buddies," Skip said. "We saw them from the lounge. They're driving around in a real army truck. Malenfant said their pricks are probably so hard they won't be able to sleep on their stomachs for a week. I thought that was pretty good for Ronnie." "When Deary comes back..." "Yeah, when he comes back." Skip shrugged as if to say all that was beyond our control. "Meanwhile, let's get out of this slop and play some cards. What do you say?" I wanted to say a lot of stuff about a lot of things, but then again I didn't. We went back inside, and by mid-afternoon the game was in full swing once more. There were 5 four-handed sub-games going on. The room was blue with smoke, and someone had dragged in a phonograph so we could listen to the Beatles and the Stones. Someone else produced a scratched-up Cameo 45 of 96 Tears, and that spun for at least an hour nonstop. Cry, cry, cry. The windows gave a good view on Bennett's Run and Bennett's Walk, and I kept looking out there, expecting to see David Dearborn and some of his khaki buddies staring at the north side of the dorm, perhaps discussing if they should go after Stoke Jones with their carbines or just chase him with their bayonets. Of course, they wouldn't do anything of the sort. They might chant, "Kill Kong! Go U.S.!" while drilling on the football field, but Stoke was a cripple. They would happily settle for seeing his commie-loving ass busted out of the University of Maine. I didn't want that to happen, but I didn't see any way it wouldn't. Stoke had had a sparrow track on the back of his coat since the beginning of school, long before the rest of us were hip to what it meant, and Deary knew it. Plus, Stoke would admit it. He'd deal with the dean and the disciplinary officer's questions the same way he dealt with his crutches, at a full-out plunge. And anyway, the whole thing began to seem distant, okay? The way classes did. The way Carol did, now that I understood she was really gone. The way the concept of being drafted and sent away to die in the jungle did. What seemed real and immediate was hunting out that bad bitch, or shooting the moon and hitting everyone else at your table with 26 points at a whack. What seemed real was hearts. But then something happened. Around 4 o'clock, the sleet changed to rain, and by 4:30, when it began to get dark, we could see that Bennett's Run was under 3 or 4 inches of water. Most of the walk looked like a canal. Below the water was a melting, slushy ice jello. The pace of the game slowed as we watched those unfortunates who were working the dish line cross from the dorms to the palace on the plains. Some of them, the wiser ones, cut across the slope of the hillside, making their way through the rapidly melting snow. The others came down the paths, slipping and sliding on their treacherous, icy surfaces. A thick mist had begun to rise from the wet ground, making it even harder for people to see where they were going. One guy from King met a girl from Franklin at the place where the paths converged. When they started up Bennett's walk together, the guy slipped and grabbed the girl. They almost went down together, but managed to keep their combined balance. We all applauded. At my table, we began a hold hand. Ronnie's weaselly little friend Nick dealt me an incredible 13 cards, maybe the best pat hand I'd ever gotten. It was a shoot-the-moon opportunity, if ever I had one. 6 high hearts and no really low ones, the king and queen of spades, plus court cards in the other 2 suits as well. I had the 7 of hearts, a borderline card, but you can catch people napping in a hold hand. No one expects you to shoot the moon in a situation where you can't improve your original draw. Lenny Doria played the douche to start us off. Ronnie immediately played void, ridding himself of the ace of spades. He thought that was great. So did I. My 2 court spades were now both winners. The queen was 13 points, but if I got all the hearts, I wouldn't eat those points. Ronnie, Nick, and Lenny would. I let Nick take the trick. We spilled 3 more tricks uneventfully. First Nick and then Lenny mined for diamonds. And then I took the 10 of hearts mixed into a club trick. "Hearts have been broken and Riley eats the first one," Ronnie bugled gleefully. "You're going down, country boy." "Maybe," I said. And maybe, I thought, Ronnie Malenfant would soon be smiling on the other side of his face. With a successful shoot, I could put the idiotic Nick Prouty over 100 and cost Ronnie a game he'd been on his way to winning. 3 tricks later, what I was doing became almost obvious. As I'd hoped, Ronnie's smirk became the expression I most enjoyed seeing on his face, the disgruntled pout. "You can't," he said. "I don't believe it. Not in a hold hand. You ain't got the fucking horses." Yet he knew it was possible. It was in his voice. "Well, let's see," I said, and played the ace of hearts. I was running in the open now, but why not? If the hearts were spread evenly, I could win the game right here. "Let's just see what we..." "Look," Skip called from the table nearest the window. His voice held disbelief and a kind of awe. "Jesus Christ, it's fucking Stokely." Play stopped. We all swiveled in our chairs to look out the window at the darkening, dripping world below us. The quartet of boys in the corner stood up to see. The old wrought iron lamps on Bennett's Walk cast weak electric beams through the ground mist, making me think of London and Tyne Street and Jack the Ripper. From its place on the hill, Holyoke Commons looked more like an ocean liner than ever. Its shape wavered as rain streamed down the lounge windows. "Fucking rip-rip, out in this crap." "I don't believe it," Ronnie breathed. Stoke came rapidly down the path which led from the north entrance of Chamberlain to the place where all the asphalt paths joined in the lowest part of Bennett's Run. He was wearing his old duffel coat, and it was clear he hadn't just come from the dorm. The coat was soaked through. Even through the streaming glass, we could see the peace sign on his back, as black as the words, which were now partly covered by a square of yellow canvas, if it was still up. His wild hair was soaked into submission. Stoke never looked toward his "Killer President" graffiti, just thumped on toward Bennett's Walk. He was going faster than I'd ever seen him move, paying no heed to the driving rain, the rising mist, or the slop under his crutches. Did he want to fall? Was he daring the slushy crap to take him down? I don't know. Maybe he was just too deep in his own thoughts to have any idea of how fast he was moving or how bad the conditions were. Either way, he wasn't going to get far if he didn't cool it. Ronnie began to giggle, and the sound spread the way a little flame spreads through dry tinder. I didn't want to join in, but was helpless to stop. So, I saw, was Skip. Partly because giggling is contagious, but also because it really was funny. I know how unkind that sounds, of course I do, but I've come too far not to tell the truth about that day. And this day, almost half a lifetime later, because it still seems funny to me, I still smile when I think back to how he looked, a frantic clockwork toy in a duffel coat, thudding along through the pouring rain, his crutches splashing up water as he went. You knew what was going to happen. You just knew it. And that was the funniest part of all, the question of just how far he could make it before the inevitable wipeout. Lenny was roaring with one hand clutched to his face, staring out between his splayed fingers, his eyes streaming. Hugh Brennan was holding his not inconsiderable gut and braying like a donkey stuck in a mud hole. Mark St. Pierre was howling uncontrollably and saying he was going to piss himself. He'd drunk too many cokes and he was going to spray his fucking jeans. I was laughing so hard I couldn't hold my cards. The nerves in my right hand went dead, my fingers relaxed, and those last few winning tricks fluttered into my lap. My head was pounding and my sinuses were full. Stoke made the bottom of the dip where the walk started. There he paused and for some reason did a crazed 360 spin, seeming to balance on one crutch. The other crutch he held out like a machine gun, as if in his mind he was spraying the whole campus. Kill Kong, slaughter proctors, bayonet those upperclassmen. And the Olympic judges give him all tens, Tony DeLuca called in a perfect sports announcer's voice. It was the final touch. The place turned into bedlam on the spot. Cards flew everywhere. Ashtrays spilled, and one of the glass ones, most were just those little aluminum table talk pie dishes, broke. Someone fell out of his chair and began to roll around, bellowing and kicking his legs. Man, we just couldn't stop laughing. That's it, Mark was howling. I just drowned my jockeys. I couldn't help it. Behind him, Nick Prouty was crawling toward the window on his knees with tears coursing down his burning face and his hands held out, the wordless begging gesture of a man who wants to say, make it stop before I burst a fucking blood vessel in the middle of my brain and die right here. Skip got up, overturning his chair. I got up. Laughing our brains out, we groped for one another and staggered toward the window with our arms slung around each other's back. Below, unaware that he was being watched and laughed at by 24 or so freaked-out card players, Stoke Jones was still, amazingly, on his feet. "Go rip-rip," Ronnie began to chant. "Go rip-rip," Nick joined in. He had reached the window and was leaning his forehead against it, still laughing. "Go rip-rip. Go, baby. Go. On, rip-rip. Mush those huskies. Work those crutches, big boy. Go, you fucking rip-rip." It was like the last play of a close football game, except everyone was chanting, "Go rip-rip," instead of "hold that line" or "block that kick." Almost everyone. I wasn't chanting, and I don't think Skip was either, but we were laughing. We were laughing just as hard as the rest. Suddenly I thought of the night Carol and I had sat on the milk boxes beside Holyoke, the night she had shown me the snapshot of herself and her childhood friends, and then told me the story of what those other boys had done to her, what they had done with the baseball bat. At first they were joking, I think, Carol had said. And had they been laughing? Probably, yeah. Because that's what you did when you were joking around, having a good time. You laughed. Stoke stood where he was for a moment, hanging from his crutches with his head down, and then he attacked the hill like the Marines going ashore at Tarawa. He went tearing up Bennett's walk, spraying water everywhere with his flying crutches. It was like watching a duck with rabies. The chant became deafening. "Go rip-rip! Go rip-rip! Go rip-rip!" At first they were joking, she had said, as we sat there on the milk boxes smoking our cigarettes. By then she was crying, her tears silver in the white light from the dining hall above us. At first they were joking, and then they weren't. That thought ended the joke of Stoke for me. I swear to you that it did. And still, I couldn't stop laughing. Stokely made it about a third of the way up the hill toward Holyoke, almost back to the visible bricks, before the slippery slop finally got him. He planted his crutches far in advance of his body, too far for even dry conditions, and when he swung forward, both sticks flew out from under him. his legs flipped up like the legs of a gymnast doing some fabulous trick on the balance beam, and he went down on his back with a tremendous splash. We could hear it even from the third-floor lounge. It was the final perfect touch. The lounge looked like a lunatic asylum where the inmates had all come down with food poisoning at the same time. We staggered aimlessly about, laughing and clutching at our throats, our eyes spouting tears. I was hanging on to Skip because my legs would no longer support me. My knees felt like noodles. I was laughing harder than I ever had in my life, harder than I ever have since, I think, and still I kept thinking about Carol sitting there on the milk box beside me, legs crossed, cigarette in one hand, snapshot in the other, Carol saying, "Harry Doolin hit me." Willie and the other one held me, so I couldn't run away. At first they were joking, I think, and then they weren't. Out on Bennett's walk, Stoke tried to sit up. He got his upper body partway out of the water, and then lay back, full length, as if that icy, slushy water were a bed. He lifted both arms skyward in a gesture which was almost invocatory, then let them fall again. It was every surrender ever given summed up in three motions, the lying back, the lifting of the arms, the double splash as they fell back wide to either side. It was the ultimate fuck it, do what you want, I quit. "Come on," Skip said. He was still laughing, but he was also completely serious. I could hear the seriousness in his laughing voice and could see it in his hysterically contorted face. I was glad it was there. God, I was glad. "Come on, before the stupid motherfucker drowns." Skip and I crammed through the doorway of the lounge, shoulder to shoulder, and sprinted down the third-floor hall, bouncing off each other like pinballs, reeling, almost as out of control as Stoke had been on the path. Most of the others followed us. The only one I know for sure who didn't was Mark. He went down to his room to change out of his soaked jeans. We met Nate on the second-floor landing. Damn near ran him down. He was standing there with an armload of books in a plastic sack, looking at us with some alarm. "Good grief," he said. That was Nate at his strongest, good grief. "What's wrong with you?" "Come on," Skip said. His throat was so choked, the words came out in a growl. If I hadn't been with him earlier, I'd have thought he'd just finished a fit of weeping. "It's not us. It's fucking Jones. He fell down. He needs..." Skip broke off his laughter, great big belly gusts of it, overtook him and shook him once again. He fell back against the wall, rolling his eyes in a kind of hilarious exhaustion. He shook his head as if to deny it, but of course you can't deny laughter. When it comes, it plops down in your favorite chair and stays as long as it wants. Above us, the stairs began to thunder with descending third-floor card players. "He needs help," Skip finished, wiping his eyes. Nate looked at me in growing bewilderment. "If he needs help, why are you guys laughing?" I couldn't explain it to him. Hell, I couldn't explain it to myself. I grabbed Skip by the arm and yanked. We started down the steps to the first floor. Nate followed us. So did the rest. The first thing I saw when we banged out through the north door was that rectangle of yellow canvas. It was lying on the ground, full of water and floating lumps of slush. Then the water on the path started pouring in through my sneakers, and I forgot all about sightseeing. It was freezing. The rain drove down on my exposed skin in needles that were not quite ice. In Bennett's run, the water was ankle deep, and my feet went from cold to numb. Skip slipped, and I grabbed his arm. Nate steadied us both from behind and kept us from tumbling over backward. Ahead of us, I could hear a nasty sound that was half coughing and half choking. Stoke lay in the water like a sodden log, his duffel coat floating around his body and those masses of black hair floating around his face. The cough was deep and bronchial. Fine droplets sprayed from his lips with each gagging, choking outburst. One of his crutches lay next to him, caught between his arm and his side. The other was floating away in the direction of Bennett Hall. Water slopped over Stoke's pale face. His coughing took on a strangled, gargling quality. His eyes stared straight up into the rain and fog. He gave no sign that he heard us coming, but when I knelt on one side of him and Skip on the other, he tried to beat us away with his hands. Water ran into his mouth, and he began to thrash. He was drowning in front of us. I no longer felt like laughing, but I might still have been doing it. At first they were joking, Carol said. At first they were joking. Put on the radio, Pete. I like the oldies. Pick him up, Skip said, and grabbed one of Stokes' shoulders. Stokes slapped at him weakly with one wax dummy hand. Skip ignored this, might not have even felt it. Hurry up, for Christ's sake. I grabbed Stokes' other shoulder. He splashed water in my face as though we were fucking around in someone's backyard pool. I had thought he'd be as cold as I was, but there was a sickish heat coming off his skin. I looked across his waterlogged body to Skip. Skip nodded back at me. Ready, set, now. We heaved. Stoke came partly out of the water, from the waist up, but that was all. I was astounded by the weight of him. His shirt had come untucked from his pants and floated around his middle like a ballerina's tutu. Below it, I could see his white skin and the black bullet hole of his navel. There were scars there, too, healed scars, wavering every which way like snarls of knotted string. "Help out, Natey," Skip grunted. "Prop him up, for fuck's sake." Nate dropped to his knees, splashing all three of us, and grabbed Stoke in a kind of backwards hug. We struggled to get him all the way up and out of the soup, but the slush on the bricks kept us off balance, made it impossible for us to work together. And Stoke, although still coughing and half-drowned, was also working against us, struggling as best he could to be free of us. Stoke wanted to go back in the water. The others arrived, Ronnie in the lead. "Fucking Rip-Rip," he breathed. He was still giggling, but he looked slightly awestruck. "You screwed up big this time, Rip." "No doubt." "Don't just stand there, you numb tool," Skip cried. "Help us." Ronnie paused a moment longer, not angry, just assessing how this might best be done, then turned to see who else was there. He slipped on the slush, and Tony DeLuca, also still giggling, grabbed him and steadied him. They were crowded together on the drowned walk, all my card-playing buddies from the third-floor lounge, and most of them still couldn't stop laughing. They looked like something, but I didn't know what. I might never have known if not for Carol's Christmas present. But, of course, that came later. "You, Tony," Ronnie said. "Brad, Lenny, Barry, let's get his legs." "What about me, Ronnie?" Nick asked. "What about me?" "You're too small to help lift him," Ronnie said, "but it might cheer him up to get his dick sucked." Nick stood back. Ronnie, Tony, Brad, Lenny, and Barry Margot slipped past us on either side. Ronnie and Tony got stoked by the calves. "Christ Jesus!" Tony cried, disgusted and still half laughing. "Nothing to him. Legs like on a scarecrow." "Legs like on a scarecrow. Legs like on a scarecrow," Ronnie cried, viciously mimicking. "Pick him the fuck up, you wop Nimrod. This isn't art appreciation. Lenny and Barry, get under his deprived ass when they do. Then you come up when the rest of you guys lift him," Lenny finished. "Got it. And don't call my paisan a wop." "Leave me alone," Stoke coughed. "Stop it. Get away from me, fucking losers." The coughing overtook him again. He began to make gruesome, retching sounds. In the lamplight, his lips looked gray and slick. "Look who's talking about being a loser," Ronnie said. "Fucking half-drowned, crippled-up Jerry's kid homo." He looked at Skip, water running out of his wavy hair and over his pimply face. "Count us off, Kirk." "One, two, three, now." We lifted. Stoke Jones came out of the water like a salvaged ship. We staggered back and forth with him. One of his arms flopped in front of me. It hung there for a moment, and then the hand attached to the end of it arced up and slapped me hard across the face. Whacko! I started laughing again. "Put me down! Motherfuckers, put me down!" We staggered, dancing on the slush, water pouring off him, water pouring off us. "Eccles!" Ronnie bawled. "Marchin! Brennan! Jesus Christ! Little help here, you fucking brain-dead ringmeats! What do you say?" Randy and Billy splashed forward. Others, three or four drawn by the shouts and splashing, most still from the third-floor Hearts group, took hold of Stoke as well. We turned him awkwardly, probably looking like the world's most spastic cheerleading squad, for some reason out practicing in the downpour. Stoke had quit struggling. He lay in our grip, arms hanging out to either side, palms up and filling with little cups of rain. Diminishing waterfalls ran out of his sodden jacket and from the seat of his pants. "He picked me up and carried me," Carol had said, talking about the boy with the crew cut, the boy who had been her first love. "All the way up Broad Street on one of the hottest days of the year, he carried me in his arms." I couldn't get her voice out of my head. In a way, I never have. "The dorm?" Ronnie asked Skip. "We taking him into the dorm?" "Jeepers, no," Nate said. "The infirmary." Since we'd managed to get him out of the water, that was the hardest part, and it was behind us. The infirmary made sense. It was a small brick building just beyond Bennett Hall, no more than 300 or 400 yards away. Once we got off the path and onto the road, the footing would be good. So we carried him to the infirmary, bore him up at shoulder height like a slain hero being ceremonially removed from the field of battle. Some of us were still laughing in little snorts and giggles. I was one of them. Once I saw Nate looking at me as if I were a thing almost below contempt, and I tried to stop the sounds that were coming out of me. I'd do okay for a little while. Then I'd think of him spinning on the pivot of his crutch. "The Olympic judges give him all tens," and I'd start in again. Stoke only spoke once as we carried him up the walk to the infirmary door. "Let me die," he said. "For once in your stupid, greedy, me lives, do something worthwhile. Put me down and let me die." The waiting room was empty, the television in the corner showing an old episode of Bonanza to no one at all. In those days, they hadn't really found the handle on color TV yet, and Pa Cartwright's face was the color of a fresh avocado. We must have sounded like a herd of hippopotami just out of the watering hole, and the duty nurse came on the run. Following her was a candy striper, probably a work-study kid like me, and a little guy in a white coat. He had a stethoscope hung around his neck and a cigarette poked in the corner of his mouth. In Atlantis, even the doctors smoked. "What's the trouble with him?" the doc asked Ronnie, either because Ronnie had an in-charge look or because he was the closest at hand. "Took a header in Bennett's run while he was on his way to Holyoke," Ronnie said. "Damn near drowned himself." He paused, then added, "He's a cripple." As if to underline this point, Billy Marchant waved one of Stoke's crutches. Apparently no one had bothered to salvage the other one. "Put that thing down. You want to fucking bonk my brains out?" Nick Prouty asked, waspishly, ducking. "What brains?" Brad responded, and we all laughed so hard we nearly dropped Stoke. "Suck me sideways, ass breath," Nick said, but he was laughing too. The doctor was frowning. "Bring him in here and save that language for your bull sessions." Stoke began coughing again, a deep, ratcheting sound. You expected to see blood and filaments of tissue come popping out of his mouth, that cough was so heavy. We carried Stoke down the infirmary hallway in a conga line, but we couldn't get him through the door that way. "Let me," Skip said. "You'll drop him," Nate said. "No," Skip said, "I won't. Just let me get a good hold." He stepped up beside Stoke, then nodded first to me on his right, then to Ronnie on his left. "Lower him down," Ronnie said. We did. Skip grunted once as he took Stoke's weight, and I saw the veins pop out in his neck. Then we stood back, and Skip carried Stoke into the room and laid him on the exam table. The thin sheet of paper covering the leather was immediately soaked. Skip stepped back. Stoke was staring up at him, his face dead pale except for two red patches high on his cheekbones. Red as rouge, those patches were. Water ran out of his hair in rivulets. "Sorry, man," Skip said. Stoke turned his head away and closed his eyes. "Out," the doctor told Skip. He had ditched the cigarette somewhere. He looked around at us, a gaggle of perhaps a dozen boys, most still grinning, all dripping on the hall's tile floor. Does anyone know the nature of his disability? It can make a difference in how we treat him. I thought of the scars I'd seen, those tangles of knotted string, but said nothing. I didn't really know anything. And now that the uncontrollable urge to laugh had passed, I felt too ashamed of myself to speak up. "It's just one of those cripple things, isn't it?" Ronnie asked. Actually faced with an adult, he had lost his shrill cockiness. He sounded unsure, perhaps even uneasy. "Muscular palsy or cerebral dystrophy or..." "You clown," Lenny said. "It's muscular dystrophy and cerebral..." "He was in a car accident," Nate said. We all looked around at him. Nate still looked neat and totally put together in spite of the soaking he'd taken. This afternoon he was wearing a Fort Kent High School ski hat. The Maine football team had finally scored a touchdown and freed Nate from his beanie. Go you Black Bears. 4 years ago, his father, mother, and older sister were killed. He was the only family survivor. There was silence. I looked between Skip and Tony's shoulders and into the examination room. Stokes still lay streaming on the table, his head turned to the side, his eyes shut. The nurse was taking his blood pressure. His pants clung to his legs, and I thought of the 4th of July parade they used to have back home in Gates Falls when I was just a little kid. Uncle Sam would come striding along between the school band and the Anna Temple Shrine guys on their midget motorcycles, looking at least 10 feet tall in his starry blue hat. But when the wind blew his pants against his legs, you could see the trick. That's what Stoke Jones's legs looked like inside his wet pants. A trick, a bad joke, sawed-off stilts with sneakers poked onto the ends of them. "How do you know that?" Skip asked. "Did he tell you, Nady?" "No." Nate looked ashamed. "He told Harry Swidrowski after a committee of resistance meeting. We were in the bear's den. Harry asked him right out what happened to his legs, and Stoke told him." I thought I understood the look on Nate's face. "After the meeting," he had said. "After." Nate didn't know what had been said at the meeting because Nate hadn't been there. Nate wasn't a member of the Committee of Resistance. Nate was strictly a sidelines boy. He might agree with the CR's goals and tactics, but he had his mother to think about, and his future as a dentist. "Spinal injury?" the doctor asked, brisker than ever. "I think so, yeah," Nate said. "All right." Doc began making shooing gestures with his hands, as if we were a flock of geese. "Go on back to your dorms. We'll take good care of him." We began to back up toward the reception area. "Why were you boys laughing when you brought him in?" the nurse asked suddenly. She stood by the doctor with the blood pressure cuff in her hands. "Why are you grinning now?" She sounded angry. Hell, she sounded furious. What was so funny about this boy's misfortune that it made you laugh? I didn't think anyone would answer. We'd just stand there and look down at our shuffling feet, realizing that we were still a lot closer to the fourth grade than we had perhaps thought. But someone did answer. Skip answered. He even managed to look at her as he did. "His misfortune, ma'am," he said. "That's what it was, you're right. It was his misfortune that was funny." "How terrible," she said. There were tears of rage standing in the corners of her eyes. "How terrible you are." "Yes, ma'am," Skip said. "I guess you're right about that, too." He turned away from her. We followed him back to the reception area in a wet and beaten little group. I can't say that being called terrible was the low point of my college career. If you can remember much of the 60s, you weren't there, the hippie known as Wavy Gravy once said. But it may have been. The waiting room was still empty. Little Joe Cartwright was on the tube now, and just as green as his dad. Pancreatic cancer was what got Michael Landon, too. He and my mother had that in common. Skip stopped. Ronnie, head down, pushed past him toward the door, followed by Nick, Billy, Lenny, and the rest. "Hold it," Skip said, and they turned. "I want to talk to you guys about something." We gathered around him. Skip glanced once toward the door leading back to the exam area, verified that we were alone, then began to talk. 10 minutes later, Skip and I walked back to the dorm by ourselves. The others had gone ahead. Nate hung with us for a little bit, then must have picked up a vibe that I wanted to talk privately to Skip. Nate was always good at picking up the vibe. I bet he's a good dentist, that the children in particular like him. "I'm done playing hearts," I said. Skip said nothing. "I don't know if it's too late to pull up my grades enough to keep my scholarship or not, but I'm going to try, and I don't care much one way or the other. The fucking scholarship's not the point." "No, they're the point, right? Ronnie and the rest of them." "I think they're only part of it." It was so cold out there as that day turned to dark, cold and damp and evil. It seemed that it would never be summer again. Man, I miss Carol. Why'd she have to go? I don't know. "When he fell over, it sounded like a nut house up there," I said. "Not a college dorm, a fucking nut house." "You laughed too, Pete. So did I." "I know," I said. "I might not have if I'd been alone, and Skip and I might not have if it had just been the two of us. But how could you tell? You were stuck with the way things played out. I kept thinking of Carol and those boys with their baseball bat. And I thought of the way Nate had looked at me, as if I were a thing below contempt." "I know." We walked in silence for a while. "I can live with laughing at him, I guess," I said, "but I don't want to wake up 40 with my kids asking me what college was like and not being able to remember anything but Ronnie Malenfant telling Polish jokes and that poor fucked-up asshole McClendon trying to kill himself with baby aspirin." I thought about Stoke Jones twirling on his crutch and felt like laughing. Thought of him lying beached on the exam table in the infirmary and felt like crying. And you know what? It was, as far as I could tell, exactly the same feeling. I just feel bad about it. I feel like shit.
"So do I," Skip said. The rain poured down around us, soaking and cold. The lights of Chamberlain Hall were bright, but not particularly comforting. I could see the yellow canvas the cops had put up lying on the grass, and above it, the dim shapes of the spray-painted letters. They were running in the rain. By the following day, they would be all but unreadable. "When I was a little kid, I always pretended I was the hero," Skip said.
"Fuck yeah, me too. What little kid ever pretended to be part of the lynch mob?"
Skip looked down at his soaked shoes, then up at me. "Could I study with you for the next couple of weeks?"
"Anytime you want."
"You really don't mind?"
"Why would I fucking mind?" I made myself sound irritated because I didn't want him to hear how relieved I was, how almost thrilled I was. "Because it might work."
I paused, then said, "This other, do you think we can pull it off?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
We had almost reached the north entrance, and I pointed to the running letters just before we went in. "Maybe Dean Gerritsen and that guy Ebersole will let the whole thing drop. The paint Stoke used didn't even get a chance to set. It'll be gone by morning."
Skip shook his head. "They won't let it drop."
"Why not? How can you be so sure?"
"Because Deary won't let them."
And of course, he was right. For the first time in weeks, the third-floor lounge was empty for a while as drenched card players dried themselves off and put on fresh clothes. Many of them also took care of some stuff Skip Kirk had suggested in the infirmary waiting room. When Nate and Skip and I came back from dinner, however, it was business as usual in the lounge. 3 tables were up and going.
"Hey, Riley," Ronnie said. "Twiller here says he's got a study date. If you want to see it, I'll teach you how to play the game."
"Not tonight," I said. "Got studying to do myself."
"Yeah," Randy Eccles said. "The art of self-abuse."
"That's right, honey. A couple more weeks of hard work and I'll be able to switch hands without missing a stroke, just like you."
As I started away, Ronnie said, "I had you stop, Riley."
I turned around. Ronnie was leaning back in his chair, smiling that unpleasant smile of his. For a short period of time, out there in the rain, I had glimpsed a different Ronnie, but that young man had gone back into hiding.
"No," I said.
You didn't. It was a done deal.
No one shoots the moon on a hold hand, Ronnie said, leaning back farther than ever. He scratched one cheek, busting the heads off a couple of pimples. They oozed tendrils of yellow-white cream.
Not at my table, they don't. I had you stopped in clubs.
You were void in clubs, unless you reneged on the first trick. You played the ace of spades when Lenny played the douche, and in hearts, I had the whole court.
Ronnie's smile faltered for just a moment, then came back strong. He waved a hand at the floor, from which all the spilled cards had been picked up. The bloody remains of the overturned ashtrays still remained. Most of us had been raised in homes where moms cleaned up such messes.
All the high hearts, huh? Too bad we can't check and see.
Yeah, too bad. I started away again.
You're going to fall behind on match points, he called after me. You know that, don't you?
You can have mine, Ronnie. I don't want them anymore.
I never played another hand of hearts in college. Many years later, I taught my kids the game, and they took to it like ducks to water. We have a tournament at the summer cottage every August. There are no match points, but there's a trophy from Atlantic Awards, a loving cup. I won it one year and kept it on my desk where I could see it. I shot the moon twice in the championship round, but neither was a hold hand. Like my old school buddy Ronnie Malenfant once said, no one shoots the moon on a hold hand. You might as well expect Atlantis to rise from the ocean, palm trees waving.
At 8 o'clock that night, Skip Kirk was at my desk and deep in his anthrotex. His hands were plunged into his hair, as if he had a bad headache. Nate was at his desk, doing a botany paper. I was sprawled on my bed, struggling with my old friend, geology. On the stereo, Bob Dylan sang, "She was the funniest woman I ever seen, the great-grandmother of Mr. Clean." There was a hard double rap on the door, pow, pow. "Floor meeting," Deary called. "Floor meeting in the rec at 9 o'clock. Attendance mandatory." "Oh, Christ," I said. "Burn the secret papers and eat the radio." Nate turned down Dylan, and we heard Deary going on up the hall, rapping that pow-pow on every door and yelling about the floor meeting in the rec. Most of the rooms he was hailing were probably empty, but no problem. He'd find the occupants down in the lounge, chasing the bitch. Skip was looking at me. "Told you," he said. Each dorm in our complex had been built at the same time, and each had a big common area in the basement, as well as the lounges in the center of each floor. There was a TV alcove, which filled up mostly for weekend sports events, and a vampire soap opera called Dark Shadows during the week. A canteen corner with half a dozen vending machines, a ping-pong table, and a number of chess and checkerboards. There was also a meeting area with a podium standing before several rows of folding wooden chairs. We'd had a floor meeting there at the beginning of the year, at which Deary had explained the dorm rules and the dire consequences of unsatisfactory room inspections. I'd have to say that room inspections were Deary's big thing. That and ROTC, of course. He stood behind the little wooden podium upon which he had laid a thin file folder. I suppose it contained his notes. He was still dressed in his damp and muddy rotsy fatigues. He looked exhausted from his day of shoveling and sanding, but he also looked excited. Turned on is how we'd put it a year or two later. Deary had been on his own at the first floor meeting. This time, he had backup. Sitting against the green cinder block wall, hands folded in his lap and knees primly together, was Sven Gerritsen, the Dean of Men. He said almost nothing during that meeting and looked benign even when the air grew stormy. Standing beside Deary, wearing a black topcoat over a charcoal gray suit and looking very can-do, was Ebersole, the disciplinary officer. After we had settled in the chairs, and those of us who smoked had lit up, Deary looked first over his shoulder at Gerritsen, then at Ebersole. Ebersole gave him a little smile. "Go ahead, David, please. They're your boys." I felt a rankle of irritation. I might be a lot of things, including a creep who laughed at cripples when they fell down in the pouring rain, but I was not Deary Dearborn's boy. Deary gripped the podium and looked at us solemnly, perhaps thinking, far back in the part of his mind reserved expressly for dreamy dreams, that a day would come when he would address his staff officers this way, setting some great tide of Hanoi-bound troops in motion.
"Jones is missing," he said finally.
It came out sounding portentous and corny, like a line in a Charles Bronson movie. "He's in the infirmary," I said, and enjoyed the surprise on Deary's face. Ebersole looked surprised, too. Gerritsen just went on gazing benignly into the middle distance, like a man on a three-pipe high. "What happened to him?" Deary asked. This wasn't in the script, either the one he had worked out or the one he and Ebersole had prepared together, and Deary began to frown. He was also gripping the podium more tightly, as if afraid it might fly away.
"Far down, go boom," Ronnie said, and puffed up when the people around him laughed. "Also, I think he's got pneumonia or double bronchitis or something like that."
He caught Skip's eye, and I thought Skip nodded slightly. This was Skip's show, not Deary's, but if we were lucky, if Stoke was lucky, the three at the front of the room would never know it. "Tell me this from the beginning," Deary said. The frown was becoming a glower. It was the way he'd looked after discovering his door had been shaving creamed. Skip told Deary and Deary's new friends how we'd seen Stoke heading toward the palace on the plains from the third-floor lounge windows, how he'd fallen into the water, how we'd rescued him and taken him to the infirmary, how the doctor had said Stoke was one sick puppy. The doc hadn't said any such thing, but he didn't need to. Those of us who had touched Stoke's skin knew that he was running a fever, and all of us had heard that horrible deep cough. Skip said nothing about how fast Stoke had been moving, as if he wanted to kill the whole world and then die himself. And he said nothing about how we laughed, Mark St. Pierre so hard he'd wet his pants. When Skip finished, Deary glanced uncertainly at Ebersole. Ebersole looked back blandly. Behind them, Dean Gerritsen continued to smile his little Buddha smile. The implication was clear. It was Deary's show. He'd better have a show to put on. Deary took a deep breath and looked back at us. "We believe Stokely Jones was responsible for the act of vandalism and public obscenity, which was perpetrated on the north end of Chamberlain Hall at a time we don't know when this morning." I'm telling you exactly what he said, not making a single word of it up, other than it became necessary to destroy the village in order to save it. That was perhaps the most sublime example of honcho speak I ever heard in my life. I believe Deary expected us to ooh and ah like the extras in a Perry Mason courtroom finale, where the revelations start coming thick and fast. Instead, we were silent. Skip watched closely, and when he saw Deary draw in another deep breath for the next pronouncement, he said, "What makes you think it was him, Deary?" Although I'm not completely sure, I never asked him, I believe Skip used the nickname purposely to throw Deary even further off his stride. In any case, it worked. Deary started to go off, looked at Ebersole, and recalculated his options. A red line was rising out of his collar. I watched it climb, fascinated. It was a little like watching a Disney cartoon where Donald Duck is trying to control his temper. You know he can't possibly do it. The suspense comes from not knowing how long he can maintain even a semblance of reason.
"I think you know the answer to that, Skip," Deary finally said. "Stokely Jones wears a coat with a very particular symbol on the back."
He picked up the folder he had carried in, removed a sheet of paper, looked at it, then turned it around so we can look at it too. None of us was very surprised by what was there. This symbol. It was invented by the Communist Party shortly after the end of the Second World War. It means victory through infiltration, and is commonly called the Broken Cross by subversives. It has also become very popular with such inner-city radical groups as the Black Muslims and the Black Panthers. Since this symbol was visible on Stoke Jones's coat long before it appeared on the side of our dorm, I hardly think it takes a rocket scientist to...
David, that is such bullshit,
Nate said, standing up. He was pale and trembling, but with anger rather than fear. Had I ever heard him say the word bullshit in public before? I don't think so. Gerritsen smiled his benign smile at my roommate. Ebersole raised his eyebrows, expressing polite interest. Deary looked stunned. I suppose the last person he expected trouble from was Nate Hoppenstand.
That symbol is based on British semaphore and stands for nuclear disarmament. It was invented by a famous British philosopher. I think he might even be a knight. To say the Russians made it up. Goodness sake. Is that what they teach you in ROTC? Bullshit like that?
Nate was staring at Deary angrily, his hands planted on his hips. Deary gaped at him, now completely knocked off his stride. Yes, they had taught him that in ROTC, and he had swallowed it, hook, line, and sinker. It made you wonder what else the ROTC kids were swallowing.
I'm sure these facts about the broken cross are very interesting, Ebersole cut in smoothly, and it's certainly information worth having. If it's true, of course.
It's true, Skip said. Bert Russell, not Joe Stalin. British kids were wearing it 5 years ago when they marched to protest the U.S. nuclear subs operating out of ports in the British Isles.
Fucking A, Ronnie cried and pumped his fist in the air. A year or so later, the Panthers, who never had much use for Bertrand Russell's peace signs, so far as I know, were doing that same thing at their rallies. And, of course, 20 years or so further on down the line, all of us cleaned-up 60s babies were doing it at rock concerts.
Bruce! Bruce!
Go, baby, Hugh Brennan chimed in, laughing. Go, Skip! Go, Big Nate!
Watch your language while the dean's here, Deary shouted at Ronnie. Ebersole ignored the profanity and the crosstalk from the peanut gallery. He kept his interested, skeptical gaze trained on my roommate and on Skip.
Even if all that's true, he said, we still have a problem, don't we? I think so. We have an act of vandalism and public obscenity. This comes at a time when the taxpaying public is looking at university youth with an ever more critical eye. And this institution depends upon the taxpaying public, gentlemen. I think it behooves us all
to think about this, Deary suddenly shouted.
His cheeks were now almost purple. His forehead swarmed with weird red spots like brands, and right between his eyes, a big vein was pulsing rapidly. Before Deary could say more, and he clearly had a lot to say, Ebersole put a hand out to his chest, shushing him. Deary seemed to deflate. He'd had his chance and fluffed it. Later, he'd perhaps tell himself it was because he was tired, while we'd spent the day in the nice warm lounge playing cards and shooting holes in our future. Deary had been outside shoveling snow and sanding walks so brittle old psychology professors wouldn't fall down and break their hips. He was tired, a little slow on the draw, and in any case, that prick Ebersole hadn't given him a fair chance to prove himself. All of which probably didn't help much with what was happening right then. He had been set aside. The grown-up was back in charge. Papa would fix.
I think it behooves us all to identify the fellow who did this and see he's punished with some severity, Ebersole continued.
Mostly it was Nate he was looking at. Amazing as it seemed to me at the time, he had identified Nate Hoppenstand as the center of the resistance he felt in the room. Nate, God bless his molars and wisdom teeth, was more than up to the likes of Ebersole. He remained standing with his hands on his hips, and his eyes never wavered, let alone dropped from Ebersole's.
How do you propose doing that? Nate asked.
What is your name, young man? Please. Nathan Hoppenstand.
Well, Nathan, I think the perpetrator has already been singled out, don't you?
Ebersole spoke in a patient, teacherly way.
Or rather, singled himself out.
I'm told this unfortunate fellow, Stokely Jones, has been a walking billboard for the broken cross symbol since...
Quit calling it that,
Skip said, and I jumped a little at the raw anger in his voice.
It's not a broken anything. It's a damn peace sign.
What is your name, sir?
Stanley Kirk. Skip to my friends. You can call me Stanley.
There was a tense little titter at this, which Ebersole seemed not to hear.
Well, Mr. Kirk, your semantic quibble is noted, but it doesn't change the fact that Stokely Jones, and Stokely Jones alone, has been displaying that particular symbol all over campus since the first day of the semester. Mr. Dearborn tells me.
Nate said, Mr. Dearborn doesn't even know what the peace sign is or where it came from, so I think you'd be sort of unwise to trust what he tells you very far. It just so happens I've got the peace sign on the back of my own jacket, Mr. Ebersole, so how do you know I wasn't the one with the spray paint? Ebersole's mouth dropped open. Not much, but enough to spoil his sympathetic smile and magazine ad good looks. And Dean Gerritsen frowned, as if presented with some concept he couldn't understand. One very rarely sees a good politician or college administrator caught completely by surprise. They are moments to treasure. I treasured that one then, and find I still do today.
That's a lie, Deary said.
He sounded more wounded than angry.
Why would you lie that way, Nate? You're the last person on three I'd expect to.
It's not a lie, Nate said. Go on up to my room and pull the peacoat out of my closet if you don't believe me. Check.
Yeah, and check mine while you're at it, I said, standing up next to Nate. My old high school jacket. You can't miss it. It's the one with the peace sign on the back.
Ebersole studied us through slightly narrowed eyes. Then he asked,
Exactly when did you put this so-called peace sign on the backs of your jackets, young fellows?
This time, Nate did lie. I knew him well enough by then to know it must have hurt, but he did it like a champ. September.
That was it for Deary. He went nuclear, is how my own kids might express it, only that wouldn't be accurate. Deary went Donald Duck. He didn't quite jump up and down, flapping his arms and going, quack, 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 like Donald does when he's mad. But he did give a howl of outrage and smacked his mottled forehead with the heels of his palms.
Ebersole stilled him again, this time by gripping his arm. Who are you? Ebersole asked me, more curt than courteous by now.
Pete Riley. I put a peace sign on the back of my jacket because I liked the look of Stokes. Also to show I've got some big questions about what we're doing over there in Vietnam.
Deary pulled away from Ebersole. His chin was thrust out, his lips pulled back enough to show a complete set of teeth.
Helping our allies is what we're doing, you doofus, he shouted. If you're too stupid to see that on your own, I suggest you take Colonel Anderson's intro military history class. Or maybe you're just another chicken guts who won't...
Hush, Mr. Dearborn, Dean Gerritsen said. His quiet was somehow louder than Deary's shouting. This is not the place for a foreign policy debate, nor is it the time for personal aspersions. Quite the contrary.
Deary dropped his burning face, studied the floor, and began to gnaw at his own lips.
And when, Mr. Riley, did you put the peace sign symbol on your jacket? Ebersole asked.
His voice remained courteous, but there was an ugly look in his eyes. He knew by then, I think, that Stoke was going to squiggle away, and Ebersole was very unhappy about that. Deary was small change next to this guy, who was in 1966 a new type on the college campuses of America. Times call the men, Lao Tzu said, and the late 60s called Charles Ebersole. He wasn't an educator. He was an enforcer, minoring in public relations.
Don't lie to me, his eyes said. Don't lie to me, Riley, because if you do and I find out, I'll turn you into salad.
But what the hell, I'd probably be gone come January 15th anyway. By Christmas of 1967, I might be in Phu Bai, keeping the place warm for Deary.
October, I said. Put it on my jacket right around Columbus Day.
I've got it on my jacket and some sweatshirts, Skip said. All that stuff's in my room. I'll show it to you if you want.
Deary, still looking down at the floor and red to the roots of his hair, was shaking his head monotonously back and forth.
I've got it on a couple of my sweatshirts, too, Ronnie said. I'm no peacenik, but it's a cool sign. I like it. Tony DeLuca said he also had one on the back of a sweatshirt. Lenny Doria told Ebersol and Gerritsen he had doodled it on the end papers of several different textbooks. It was on the front of his general assignments notebook as well. He'd show them if they wanted to see. Billy Marchant had it on his jacket. Brad Witherspoon had inked it on his freshman beanie. The beanie was in the back of his closet somewhere, probably beneath the underwear he'd forgotten to take home for his mom to wash. Nick Prouty said he'd drawn peace signs on his favorite record albums, MC5's Kick Out the Jams and Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders. You ain't got any mind to bend, Dinkleballs, Ronnie muttered, and there was laughter from behind cupped hands. Several others reported having the peace sign on books or items of clothing. All claimed to have done this long before the discovery of the graffiti on the north end of Chamberlain Hall. In a final surreal touch, Hugh stood up, stepped into the aisle, and hiked the legs of his jeans so we could see the yellowing athletic socks climbing his hairy shins. A peace sign had been drawn on both, with the laundry marker Mrs. Brennan had sent to school with her baby boy. It was probably the first time the fucking thing had been used all semester. So you see, Skip said when show and tell was over, it could have been any of us. Deary slowly raised his head. All that remained of his flush was a single red patch over his left eye. It looked like a blister. Why are you lying for him? He asked. He waited, but no one answered. Not one of you had a peace sign on a single thing before Thanksgiving break. I'd swear to it, and I bet most of you never had one on anything before tonight. Why are you lying for him? No one answered. The silence spun out. In it, there grew a sense of power, an unmistakable force we all felt. But who did it belong to? Them or us? There was no way of saying. All these years later, there's still no real way of saying. Then Dean Gerritsen stepped to the podium. Deary moved aside without even seeming to see him. The dean looked at us with a small and cheerful smile.
This is foolishness, he said. What Mr. Jones wrote on the wall was foolishness, and this lying is more foolishness. Tell the truth, men. Fess up.
No one said anything.
We'll be speaking to Mr. Jones in the morning, Ebersol said. Perhaps after we do, some of you fellows may want to change your stories a bit.
Oh, man, I wouldn't put too much trust in anything Stoke might tell you, Skip said.
Right, old Rip-Rip's crazy as a shithouse rat, Ronnie said.
There was strangely affectionate laughter at this.
Shithouse rat, Nick cried, eyes shining.
He was as joyful as a poet who has finally found le mot juste.
Shithouse rat, yeah, that's old Rip.
And in what was probably that day's final triumph of lunacy over rational discourse, Nick Prouty fell into an eerily perfect Foghorn-Leghorn imitation.
I'll say the boy's crazy, missing a wheel off his baby carriage, lost two or three cards out in his deck, fellas a beer short of a six-pack.
Ease.
Nick gradually realized that Ebersol and Gerritsen were looking at him, Ebersol with contempt, Gerritsen almost with interest, as at a new bacterium glimpsed through the lens of a microscope.
You know, sick in the head, Nick finished,
losing the imitation as self-consciousness, that bane of all great artists, set in. He quickly sat down.
That's not the kind of sick I meant, exactly, Skip said. I'm not talking about him being a cripple, either. He's been sneezing, coughing, and running at the nose ever since he got here. Even you must have noticed that, Deary.
Deary didn't reply, didn't even react to the use of the nickname this time. He must have been pretty tired, all right.
All I'm saying is that he might claim a whole lot of stuff, Skip said. He might even believe some of it, but he's out of it.
Ebersol's smile had resurfaced, no humor in it now.
I believe I grasp the thrust of your argument, Mr. Kirk. You want us to believe that Mr. Jones was not responsible for the writing on the wall, but if he does confess to having done it, we should not credit his statement.
Skip also smiled, the thousand-watt smile that made the girls' hearts go giddy up.
"That's it," he said. "That's the thrust of my argument, all right."
There was a moment's silence, and then Dean Garretson spoke what could have been the epitaph of our brief age.
"You fellows have disappointed me," he said. "Come on, Charles, we have no further business here."
Garretson hoisted his briefcase, turned on his heel, and headed for the door. Eversole looked surprised, but hurried after him, which left Deary and his third-floor charges to stare at each other with mingled expressions of distrust and reproach.
"Thanks, guys!"
David was almost crying.
"Thanks a fucking pantload!"
He stalked out with his head down and his folder clutched in one hand. The following semester, he left Chamberlain and joined a frat. All things considered, that was probably for the best. As Stoke might have said, Deary had lost his credibility.
"So you stole that, too," Stoke Jones said from his bed in the infirmary when he could finally talk. "I had just told him that almost everyone in Chamberlain Hall was now wearing the sparrow track on at least one article of clothing, thinking this news would cheer him up. I had been wrong."
"Settle down, man," Skip said, patting his shoulder. "Don't have a hemorrhage."
Stoke never so much as glanced at him. His black, accusing eyes remained on me.
"You took the credit, then you took the peace sign. Did any of you check my wallet? I think there were $9 or $10 in there. You could have had that, too, made it a clean sweep."
He turned his head aside and began to cough weakly. On that cold day in early December of 66, he looked one fuck of a lot older than 18.
This was 4 days after Stoke went swimming in Bennett's Run. The doctor, Carberry his name was, seemed by the second of those days to accept that most of us were Stoke's friends, no matter how oddly we'd acted when we brought him in, because we kept stopping by to ask after him. Carberry had been at the college infirmary, prescribing for strep throats and splitting wrists dislocated in softball games, for donkey's years, and probably knew there was no accounting for the behavior of young men and women homing in on their majority. They might look like adults, but most retained plenty of their childhood weirdnesses as well. Nick Prouty auditioning Foghorn Leghorn for the Dean of Men, for instance. I rest my case.
Carberry never told us how bad things had been with Stoke. One of the candy stripers, half in love with Skip by the second time she saw him, I believe, gave us a clearer picture, not that we really needed one. The fact that Carberry stuck him in a private room instead of on men's side told us something. The fact that we weren't allowed to so much as peek in on him for the first 48 hours of his stay told us more. The fact that he hadn't been moved to eastern Maine, which was only 10 miles up the road, told us most of all. Carberry hadn't dared move him, not even in the university ambulance. Stoke Jones had been in bad straits indeed. According to the candy striper, he had pneumonia, incipient hypothermia from his dunk, and a temperature which crested at 105 degrees. She'd overheard Carberry talking with someone on the phone and saying that if Jones's lung capacity had been any further reduced by his disability, or if he'd been in his 30s or 40s instead of his late teens, he almost certainly would have died. Skip and I were the first visitors he was allowed. Any other kid in the dorm probably would have been visited by at least one parent, but that wasn't going to happen in Stokes' case. We knew that now. And if there were other relatives, they hadn't bothered to put in an appearance. We told him everything that had happened that night, with one exception, the laugh-in, which had begun in the lounge when we saw him spraying his way through Bennett's Run, and continued until we delivered him, semi-conscious, to the infirmary. He listened silently as I told him about Skip's idea to put peace signs on our books and clothes so Stoke couldn't be hung out all by himself. Even Ronnie Malenfant had gone along, I said, and without a single quibble. We told him so he could jibe his story with ours. We also told him so he'd understand that by trying to take the blame or credit for the graffiti now, he'd get us in trouble as well as himself. And we told him without ever coming right out and telling him. We didn't need to. His legs didn't work, but the stuff between his ears was just fine.
"Get your hand off me, Kirk.
Stoke hunched as far away from us as his narrow bed would allow, then began to cough again. I remember thinking he looked like he had about 4 months to live, but I was wrong about that. Atlantis sank, but Stoke Jones is still in the swim, practicing law in San Francisco. His black hair has gone silver and is prettier than ever. He's got a red wheelchair and looks great on CNN. Skip sat back and folded his arms. I didn't expect wild gratitude, but this is too much, he said. You've outdone yourself this time, Rip Rip. His eyes flashed. Don't call me that. Then don't call us thieves just because we tried to save your scrawny ass. Hell, we did save your scrawny ass. No one asked you to. No, I said. You don't ask anyone for anything, do you? I think you're going to need bigger crutches to haul around a chip on your shoulder before long. That chip's what I've got, shithead. What have you got? A lot of catching up to do. That's what I had. But I didn't tell Stoke that. Somehow, I didn't think he'd exactly melt with sympathy. How much of that day do you remember? I asked him. I remember putting the Fuck Johnson thing on the dorm. I'd been planning that for a couple of weeks, and I remember going to my 1 o'clock class. I spent most of it thinking about what I was going to say in the dean's office when he called me in. What kind of a statement I was going to make. After that, everything fades into little fragments. He uttered a sardonic laugh and rolled his eyes in their bruised-looking sockets. He'd been in bed for the best part of a week and still looked unutterably tired. I think I remember telling you guys I wanted to die. Did I say that? I didn't answer. He gave me all the time in the world, but I stood on my right to remain silent. At last, Stoke shrugged, the kind of shrug that says, okay, let's drop it. It pulled the Johnny he was wearing off one bony shoulder. He tugged it back into place, using his hand carefully. There was an IV drip in it. So you guys discovered the peace sign, huh? Great. You can wear it when you go to see Neil Diamond or fucking Petula Clark at Winter Carnival. Me? I'm out of here. This is over for me. If you go to school on the other side of the country, do you think you'll be able to throw the crutches away? Skip asked. Maybe run track? I was a little shocked, but Stoke smiled. It was a real smile, too, sunny and unaffected. The crutches aren't relevant, he said. Time's too short to waste. That's relevant. People around here don't know what's happening, and they don't care. They're gray people, just getting by people. In Orono, Maine, buying a Rolling Stones record passes for a revolutionary act. Some people know more than they did, I said, but I was troubled by thoughts of Nate, who had been worried his mother might see a picture of him getting arrested and had stayed on the curb in consequence. A face in the background. The face of a gray boy on the road to dentistry in the 20th century. Dr. Carberry stuck his head in the door. Time you are on your way, men. Mr. Jones has a lot of rest to catch up on. We stood. When Dean Gerritsen comes to talk to you, I said, or that guy Ebersole, as far as they'll ever know, that whole day is a blank, Stoke said. Carberry can tell them I had bronchitis since October and pneumonia since Thanksgiving, so they'll have to accept it. I'll say I could have done anything that day, except, you know, drop the old crutches and run the 440. We really didn't steal your sign, you know, Skip said. We just borrowed it. Stoke appeared to think this over, then sighed. It's not my sign, he said. No, I agreed. Not anymore. So long, Stoke. We'll come back and see you. Don't make it a priority, he said, and I guess we took him at his word because we never did. I saw him back at the dorm a few times, but only a few, and I was in class when he moved out without bothering to finish the semester. The next time I saw him was on the TV news almost 20 years later, speaking at a Greenpeace rally just after the French blew up the Rainbow Warrior. 1984 or 85, that would have been. Since then, I've seen him on the tube quite a lot. He raises money for environmental causes, speaks on college campuses from that snazzy red wheelchair, defends the eco-activists in court when they need defending. I've heard him called a tree hugger, and I bet he sort of enjoys that. He's still carrying that chip. I'm glad. Like he said, it's what he's got. As we reached the door, he called, "Hey?" We looked back at a narrow white face, on a white pillow above a white sheet, the only real color about him those masses of black hair. The shapes of his legs under the sheet again made me think of Uncle Sam in the 4th of July parade back home. And again I thought that he looked like a kid with about 4 months to live, but add some white teeth to the picture as well, because Stoke was smiling. "Hey, what?" Skip said. "You two were so concerned with what I was going to say to Gerritsen and Ebersole. Maybe I've got an inferiority complex or something, but I have trouble believing all that concern is for me. Have you two decided to actually try going to school for a change?" "If we did, do you think we'd make it?" Skip asked. "You might," Stoke said. "There is one thing I remember about that night, pretty clearly, too." I thought he'd say he remembered us laughing at him. Skip thought so, too, he told me later, but that wasn't it. "You carried me through the doorway of the exam room by yourself," he said to Skip. "Didn't drop me, either." "No chance of that. You don't weigh much. Still, dying's one thing, but no one likes the idea of being dropped on the floor. It's undignified." "Because you didn't, I'll give you some good advice. Get out of the sports programs, Kirk. Unless, that is, you've got some kind of athletic scholarship you can't do without."
"Why?"
"Because they'll turn you into someone else. It may take a little longer than it took Rossi to turn David Dearborn into Deary, but they'll get there in the end." "What do you know about sports?" Skip asked gently. "What do you know about being on a team?" "I know it's a bad time for boys in uniforms," Stoke said, then lay back on his pillow and closed his eyes. "But a good time to be a girl," Carol had said. 1966 was a good time to be a girl. We returned to the dorm and went to my room to study. Down the hall, Ronnie and Nick and Lenny and most of the others were chasing the bitch. After a while, Skip shut the door to block the sound of them out, and when that didn't entirely work, I turned on Nate's little RCA swing line, and we listened to Phil Oakes. Oakes is dead now, as dead as my mother and Michael Landon. He hanged himself with his belt right around the time Stoke Jones was going high profile with Greenpeace. The suicide rate among surviving Atlanteans has been pretty high. No surprise there, I guess. When your continent sinks right out from under your feet, it does a number on your head. A day or two after that visit to Stoke in the infirmary, I called my mother and said that if she could really afford to send a little extra cash my way, I'd like to take her up on her idea about getting a tutor. She didn't ask many questions and didn't scold. You knew you were in serious trouble with my mom when she didn't scold. But 3 days later, I had a money order for $300. To this, I added my heart's winnings. I was astonished to find they came to almost $80. That's a lot of nickels. I never told my mom, but I actually hired two tutors with her $300. One a grad student who helped me with the mysteries of tectonic plates and continental drift. The other a pot-smoking senior from King Hall who helped Skip with his anthropology and might have written a paper or two for him, although I don't know that for sure. This second fellow's name was Harvey Brundage, and he was the first person to ever say, "Wow, man, bummer," in my presence. Together, Skip and I went to the Dean of Arts and Sciences. There was no way we were going to go to Gerritsen, not after that November meeting in the Chamberlain Rec, and laid out the problems we were facing. Technically, neither of us belonged to ANS. As freshmen, we weren't yet eligible to declare majors, but Dean Randall listened to us. He recommended that we go around to each of our instructors and explain the problem. More or less throw ourselves on their mercy. We did it, loathing every minute of the process. One of the factors that made us powerful friends in those years was being raised with the same Yankee ideas, one of which was that you didn't ask for help unless you absolutely had to, and maybe not even then. The only thing that got us through that embarrassing round of calls was the buddy system. When Skip was in with his teachers, I waited for him out in the hall, smoking one cigarette after another. When it was my turn, he waited for me. As a group, the instructors were a lot more sympathetic than I ever would have guessed. Most bent over backwards to help us not only pass, but pass high enough to hold on to our scholarships. Only Skip's calculus teacher was completely unreceptive, and Skip was doing well enough there to skate by without any special help. Years later, I realized that for many of the instructors it was a moral issue rather than an academic one. They didn't want to read their ex-students' names in a casualty list and have to wonder if they had been partially responsible, that the difference between a D and a C- had also been the difference between a kid who could see and hear and one sitting senseless in a VA hospital somewhere. After one of these meetings, and with the end of semester exams looming, Skip went to the Bear's Den to meet his anthro tutor for a coffee-fueled cram session. I had dish line at Holyoke. When the conveyor finally shut down for the afternoon, I went back to the dorm to resume my own studies. I stopped in the lobby to check my mailbox, and there was a pink package slip in it. The package was brown paper and string, but livened up with some stick-on Christmas bells and holly. The return address hit me in the stomach like an unexpected sucker punch. Carol Gerber, 172 Broad Street, Harwich, Connecticut. I hadn't tried to call her, and not just because I was busy trying to save my ass. I don't think I realized the real reason until I saw her name on that package. I'd been convinced she'd gone back to Sully John, that the night we'd made love in my car while the oldies played was ancient history to her now, that I was ancient history. Phil Oakes was playing on Nate's record player, but Nate himself was snoozing on his bed with a copy of Newsweek lying open on his face. General William Westmoreland was on the cover. I sat down at my desk, put the package in front of me, reached for the string, then paused. My fingers were trembling. "Hearts are tough," she had said. "Most times they don't break. Most times they only bend." She was right, of course, but mine hurt as I sat there looking at the Christmas package she had sent me. It hurt plenty. Phil Oakes was on the record player, but in my mind I was hearing older, sweeter music. In my mind, I was hearing the Platters. I snapped the string, tore the tape, removed the brown paper, and eventually liberated a small white department store box. Inside was a gift wrapped in shiny red paper and white satin ribbon. There was also a square envelope with my name written on it, in her familiar hand. I opened the envelope and pulled out a Hallmark card, "When you care enough to send the very best," and all that. There were foil snowflakes and foil angels blowing foil trumpets. When I opened the card, a newspaper clipping fell out onto the present she'd sent me. It was from a newspaper called the Harwich Journal. In the top margin, above the headline, Carol had written, "This time I made it, Purple Heart. Don't worry, 5 stitches at the emerge room and I was home for supper." The story's headline read, 6 injured, 14 arrested as draft office protest turns into melee. The photo was in stark contrast to the one in the Derry News, where everyone, even the cops and the construction workers who had started their own impromptu counter-protest, looked sort of relaxed. In the Harwich Journal photo, folks looked raw-nerved, confused, and about 2,000 light-years from relaxed. There were hard-hat types with tattoos on their bulging arms and hateful grimaces on their faces. There were long-haired kids staring back at them with angry defiance. One of the latter was holding his arms out to a jeering trio of men as if to say, "Come on, you want a piece of me?" There were cops between the two groups, looking strained and tense. To the left, Carol had drawn an arrow to this part of the photo, as if I might have missed it otherwise, was a familiar jacket with Harwich High School printed on the back. Once more her head was turned, but this time toward the camera instead of away from it. I could see the blood running down her cheek much more clearly than I wanted to. She could draw joke arrows and write all the breezy comments she wanted to in the margin. I was not amused. That was not chocolate syrup on her face. A cop had her by one arm. The girl in the news photo didn't seem to mind either that or the fact that her head was bleeding. if she even knew her head was bleeding at that point. The girl in the news photo was smiling. In one of her hands was a sign reading, "Stop the murder." The other was held out toward the camera, the first two fingers making a V. V for victory, I thought then, but of course it wasn't. By 1969, that V went with the sparrow track the way ham went with eggs. I scanned the text of the clipping, but there was nothing there of any particular interest. Protest, counter-protest, epithets, thrown rocks, a few fistfights, police arrive on the scene. The story's tone was lofty and disgusted and patronizing all at the same time. It reminded me of how Ebersole and Gerritsen had looked that night in the wreck. You fellows have disappointed me. All but three of the protesters who had been arrested were released later that day, and none were named, so presumably they were all under 21. Blood on her face, and yet she was smiling, triumphant, in fact. I became aware Phil Oakes was still singing, "I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again," and a shake of goose flesh went up my back. I turned to the card. It bore the typical rhymed sentiments. They always come to about the same, don't they? Merry Christmas. Sure hope you don't die in the new year. I barely read them. On the blank side, facing the verse, she had written me a note. It was long enough to use up most of the white space. Dear number six, I just wanted to wish you the merriest of Merry Christmases and to tell you I'm okay. I'm not back in school, although I have been associating with certain school types, see enclosed clipping, and expect I will return eventually, probably fall semester next year. My mom is not doing too well, but she is trying, and my brother is getting his act back together. Rhonda helps, too. I've seen Sully a couple of times, but it's not the same. He came over to watch TV one night, and we are like strangers. Or maybe what I really mean is that we're like old acquaintances on trains going in different directions. I miss you, Pete. I think our trains are going in different directions, too, but I'll never forget the time we spent together. It was the sweetest and the best, especially the last night. You can write me if you want, but I sort of wish you wouldn't. It might not be good for either of us. This doesn't mean I don't care or remember, but that I do. Remember the night I showed you that picture and told you about how I got beaten up? How my friend Bobby took care of me? He had a book that summer. The man upstairs gave it to him. Bobby said it was the best book he ever read. Not saying much when you're just 11, I know. But I saw it again in the high school library when I was a senior and read it, just to see what it was like. And I thought it was pretty great. Not the best book I ever read, but pretty great. I thought you might like a copy. Although it was written 12 years ago, I sort of think it's about Vietnam. Even if it's not, it's full of information. I love you, Pete. Merry Christmas, Carol. P.S. Get out of that stupid card game. I read it twice, then folded the clipping carefully and put it back in the card, my hands still shaking. Somewhere I think I still have that card, as I'm sure that somewhere Red Carol Gerber has still got her little snapshot of her childhood friends. If she's still alive, that is. Not exactly a sure thing. A lot of her last known bunch of friends are not. I opened the package. Inside it, and in jarring contrast to the cheery Christmas paper and white satin ribbon, was a paperback copy of Lord of the Flies by William Golding. I had somehow missed it in high school, opting for a separate piece in senior lit instead because piece looked a little shorter. I opened it, thinking there might be an inscription. There was, but not the sort I had expected, not at all. What I found in the white space on the title page was a Valentine heart, the sort a child might draw, followed by a plus sign, a peace sign, and then an equal sign. On the right side of the equation was one word. I spoke the whole thing aloud in a whisper that hardly escaped my mouth. Love plus peace equals information. My eyes filled with sudden, unexpected tears. I put my hands over my mouth to hold in the sob that wanted to come out. I didn't want to wake Nate up, didn't want him to see me crying. But I cried all right. I sat there at my desk and cried for her, for me, for both of us, for all of us. I can't remember hurting any more in my life than I did then. Hearts are tough, she said. Most times hearts don't break, and I'm sure that's right. But what about then? What about who we were then? What about hearts in Atlantis? In any case, Skip and I survived. We did the makeup work, squeaked through the finals, and returned to Chamberlain Hall in mid-January. Skip told me he'd written a letter to John Winken, the baseball coach, over the holiday, saying he'd changed his mind about coming out for the team. Nate was back on Chamberlain 3. So, amazingly, was Lenny Doria, on academic pro, but there. His paisan, Tony DeLuca, was gone, though. So were Mark St. Pierre, Barry Margot, Nick Prouty, Brad Witherspoon, Harvey Twiller, Randy Eccles, and Ronnie, of course. We got a card from him in March. It was postmarked Lewiston and simply addressed to the Yo-Yos of Chamberlain 3. We taped it up in the lounge, over the chair where Ronnie had most often sat during the games. On the front was Alfred E. Newman, the Mad Magazine cover boy. On the back, Ronnie had written, Uncle Sam calls and I gotta go. Palm trees in my future and who gives an F blank blank K? What me worry? I finished with 21 match points. That makes me the winner. It was signed, Ron. Skip and I had a laugh at that. As far as we were concerned, Mrs. Malenfant's foul-mouthed little boy was going to be a Ronnie until the day he died. Stoke Jones, a.k.a. Rip Rip, was also gone. I didn't think of him much for a while, but his face and memory came back to me with startling, if brief, vividness, a year and a half later. I was in jail at the time, in Chicago. I don't know how many of us the cops swept up outside the convention center on the night Hubert Humphrey was nominated, but there were a lot, and a lot of us were hurt. A Blue Ribbon Commission would a year later designate the event a police riot in its report. I ended up in a holding cell meant for 15 prisoners, 20 max, with about 60 gassed out, punched out, drugged out, beat up, messed up, worked over, fucked over, blood all over hippies, some smoking joints, some crying, some puking, some singing protest songs. From far over in the corner, issuing from some guy I never even saw, came a stoned-out version of, I'm not marching anymore. It was like some weird penal version of telephone booth cramming. I was jammed up against the bars, trying to protect my shirt pocket, Paul Mall's, and my hip pocket, the copy of Lord of the Flies Carol had given me, now very battered, missing half its front cover and falling out of its binding, when all at once, Stoke's face flashed into my mind as bright and complete as a high-resolution photograph. It came from nowhere, it seemed. Perhaps the product of a dormant memory circuit which had gone momentarily hot, joggled by either a nightstick to the head or a revivifying whiff of tear gas. And a question came with it. What the fuck was a cripple doing on the third floor? I asked out loud. A little guy with a huge mass of golden hair, a kind of Peter Frampton dwarf, if you could dig that, looked around. His face was pale and pimply. Blood was drying beneath his nose and on one cheek. What, man? He asked. What the fuck was a cripple doing on the third floor of a college dorm, one with no elevator? Wouldn't they have put him on the first floor? Then I remembered Stoke plunging toward Holyoke with his head down and his hair hanging in his eyes, Stoke muttering, rip, 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 under his breath. Stoke going everywhere, as if everything was his enemy. Give him a quarter, and he'd try to shoot down the whole world. Man, I'm not following you. What? Unless he asked them to, I said. Unless he maybe right out demanded it. Bingo, said the little guy with the Peter Frampton hair. Got a joint, man? I want to get high. This place sucks. I want to go to Hobbiton. Skip became an artist. And he's famous in his own way. Not like Norman Rockwell, and you'll never see a reproduction of one of Skip's sculptures on a plate offered by the Franklin Mint. But he's had plenty of shows. London, Rome, New York, last year in Paris. and he's reviewed regularly. There are plenty of critics who call him Jejun, the flavor of the month. Some have been calling him the flavor of the month for 25 years. A trite mind communicating via low imagery with other trite minds. Other critics have praised him for his honesty and energy. I tend in this direction, but I suppose I would. I knew him back in the day. We escaped the great sinking continent together, and he has remained my friend. In a distant way, he has remained my paisan. There are also critics who have commented on the rage his work so often expresses, the rage I first saw clearly in the papier-mâché Vietnamese family tableau. He set a fire in front of the school library to the amplified pulse of the Youngbloods back in 1969. And yeah, there's something to that. Some of Skip's stuff is funny, and some of it's sad, and some of it's bizarre, but most of it looks angry. Most of his stiff-shouldered plaster and paper and clay people seem to whisper, "Light me, oh, light me and listen to me scream." It's really still 1969. It's still the Mekong and always will be. It is Stanley Kirk's anger which makes his work worthy, a critic wrote during an exhibition in Boston, and I suppose it was that same anger which contributed to his heart attack 2 months ago. His wife called and said Skip wanted to see me. The doctors believed it hadn't been a serious cardiac event, but the captain begged to disagree. My old paisan Captain Kirk thought he was dying. I flew down to Palm Beach, and when I saw him, white face below mostly white hair on a white pillow, it called up a memory I could not at first pin down. "You're thinking of Jones," he said in a husky voice, and of course he was right. I grinned, and at the same moment a cold chill traced a finger down the middle of my back. Sometimes things come back to you, that's all. Sometimes they come back. I came in and sat down beside him. "Not bad, O Swami." "Not hard, either," he said. "It's that day at the infirmary all over again, except that Carberry's probably dead, and this time I'm the one with the tube in the back of my hand." He raised one of his talented hands, showed me the tube, then lowered it again. "I don't think I'm going to die anymore. At least, not yet." "Good. You still smoking?"
"I've retired, as of last year."
He nodded. "My wife says she'll divorce me if I don't do the same, so I guess I better try."
"It's the worst habit."
"Actually, I think living's the worst habit."
"Save the phrase-making shit for the Reader's Digest, Cap."
He laughed, then asked if I'd heard from Nate.
"A Christmas card, like always, with a photo."
"Fucking Nate." Skip was delighted. "Was it his office?"
"Yeah. He's got a nativity scene out front this year. The Magi all look like they need dental work." We looked at each other and began to giggle. Before Skip could really get going, he began to cough. It was eerily like Stoke. For a moment, he even looked like Stoke. And I felt that shiver slide down my back again. If Stoke had been dead, I'd have thought he was haunting us, but he wasn't. And in his own way, Stoke Jones was as much of a sellout as every retired hippie who progressed from selling cocaine to selling junk bonds over the phone. He loves his TV coverage, does Stoke. When O.J. Simpson was on trial, you could catch Stoke somewhere on the dial every night, just another vulture circling the carrion. Carol was the one who didn't sell out, I guess. Carol and her friends, and what about the chem students they killed with their bomb? It was a mistake. I believe that with all my heart. The Carol Gerber I knew would have no patience with the idea that all power comes out of the barrel of a gun. The Carol I knew would have understood that was just another fucked-up way of saying we had to destroy the village in order to save it. But do you think the relatives of those kids care that it was a mistake? The bomb didn't go off when it was supposed to? Sorry? Do you think questions of who sold out and who didn't matter to the mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, lovers, friends? Do you think it matters to the people who have to pick up the pieces and somehow go on? Hearts can break. Yes, hearts can break. Sometimes I think it would be better if we died when they did, but we don't. Skip worked on getting his breath back. The monitor beside his bed was beeping in a worried way. A nurse looked in and Skip waved her off. The beeps were settling back to their previous rhythm, so she went. When she was gone, Skip said, "Why did we laugh so hard when he fell down that day?" That question has never entirely left me. "No," I said, "me either." "So what's the answer? Why did we laugh?"
"Because we're human."
For a while, I think it was between Woodstock and Kent State, we thought we were something else, but we weren't.
"We thought we were stardust," Skip said, almost with a straight face.
"We thought we were golden," I agreed, laughing,
"and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden."
"Lean over, hippie boy," Skip said, and I did. I saw that my old friend, who had outfoxed Deary and Ebersole and the Dean of Men, who had gone around and begged his teachers to help him, who had taught me to drink beer by the pitcher and say fuck in a dozen different intonations, was crying a little bit. He reached up his arms to me. They had gotten thin over the years, and now the muscles hung rather than bunched. I bent down and hugged him. "We tried," he said in my ear. "Don't you ever forget that, Pete. We tried." I suppose we did. In her way, Carol tried harder than any of us and paid the highest price, except, that is, for the ones who died. And although we've forgotten the language we spoke in those years, it is as lost as the bell-bottom jeans, home tie-dyed shirts, Nehru jackets, and signs that said, "Killing for peace is like fucking for chastity." Sometimes a word or two comes back. Information, you know. Information. And sometimes, in my dreams and memories, the older I get, the more they seem to be the same. I smell the place where I spoke that language with such easy authority. A whiff of earth, a scent of oranges, and the fading smell of flowers.
"1983. God bless us, everyone." Blind Willie. 6:15 a.m. He wakes to music, always to music. The shrill beep, beep, beep of the clock radio's alarm is too much for his mind to cope with during those first blurry moments of the day. It sounds like a dump truck backing up. The radio is bad enough at this time of year, though. The easy listening station he keeps the clock radio tuned to is wall-to-wall Christmas carols. And this morning he wakes up to one of the two or three on his most hated list, something full of breathy voices and phony wonder. The Hare Krishna Chorale or the Andy Williams Singers or some such. "Do you hear what I hear?" the breathy voices sing as he sits up in bed, blinking groggily, hair sticking out in every direction. "Do you see what I see?" they sing as he swings his legs out, grimaces his way across the cold floor to the radio, and bangs the button that turns it off. When he turns around, Sharon has assumed her customary defensive posture, pillow folded over her head, nothing showing but the creamy curve of one shoulder, a lacy nightgown strap, and a fluff of blonde hair. He goes into the bathroom, closes the door, slips off the pajama bottoms he sleeps in, drops them into the hamper, clicks on his electric razor. As he runs it over his face, he thinks, "Why not run through the rest of the sensory catalog while you're at it, boys? Do you smell what I smell? Do you taste what I taste? Do you feel what I feel? I mean, hey, go for it." "Humbug," he says as he turns on the shower. "All humbug." 20 minutes later, while he's dressing, the dark gray suit from Paul Stewart this morning, plus his favorite sulca tie, Sharon wakes up a little. Not enough for him to fully understand what she's telling him, though. "Come again?" he asks. "I got eggnog, but the rest was just ugga wugga." "I asked if you'd pick up 2 quarts of eggnog on your way home," she says. "We've got the Allens and the Dubrays coming over tonight, remember?" "Christmas," he says, checking his hair carefully in the mirror. He no longer looks like the glaring, bewildered man who sits up in bed to the sound of music 5 mornings a week, sometimes 6. Now he looks like all the other people who will ride into New York with him on the 740, and that is just what he wants. "What about Christmas?" she asks with a sleepy smile. "Humbug, right?" "Right," he agrees. "If you remember, get some cinnamon, too." "Okay, but if you forget the eggnog, I'll slaughter you, Bill." "I'll remember." "I know. You're very dependable. Look nice, too." "Thanks." She flops back down, then props herself up on one elbow as he makes a final minute adjustment to the tie, which is a dark blue. He has never worn a red tie in his life and hopes he can go to his grave untouched by that particular virus. "I got the tinsel you wanted," she says. "Hmm?" "The tinsel," she says. "It's on the kitchen table." "Oh, now he remembers. Thanks." "Sure." She's back down and already starting to drift off again. He doesn't envy the fact that she can stay in bed until 9. Hell, until 11 if she wants. But he envies that ability of hers to wake up, talk, then drift off again. He had that when he was in the bush. Most guys did. But the bush was a long time ago. In country was what the new guys and the correspondents always said. If you'd been there a while, it was just the bush. Or sometimes the green. In the green, yeah. She says something else, but now she's back to ugga wugga. He knows what it is just the same, though. "Have a good day, hon." "Thanks," he says, kissing her cheek. "I will." "Look very nice," she mumbles again, although her eyes are closed. "Love you, Bill." "Love you, too," he says, and goes out. His briefcase, Mark Cross, not quite top of the line but close, is standing in the front hall by the coat tree where his top coat, from Tagers on Madison, hangs. He snags the case on his way by and takes it into the kitchen. The coffee is all made, God bless Mr. Coffee, and he pours himself a cup. He opens the briefcase, which is entirely empty, and picks up the ball of tinsel on the kitchen table. He holds it up for a moment, watching the way it sparkles under the light of the kitchen fluorescence, then puts it in his briefcase. "Do you hear what I hear?" he says to no one at all, and snaps the briefcase shut. 8:15 a.m. Outside the dirty window to his left, he can see the city drawing closer. The grime on the glass makes it look like some filthy, gargantuan ruin. Dead Atlantis, maybe, just heaved back to the surface to glare at the gray sky. The day's got a load of snow caught in its throat, but that doesn't worry him much. It is just 8 days until Christmas, and business will be good. The train car reeks of morning coffee, morning deodorant, morning aftershave, morning perfume, and morning stomachs. There is a tie in almost every seat. Even some of the women wear them these days. The faces have that puffy 8 o'clock look, the eyes both introspective and defenseless, the conversation's half-hearted. This is the hour at which even people who don't drink look hungover. Most folks just stick to their newspapers. Why not? Reagan is king of America. Stocks and bonds have turned to gold. The death penalty is back in vogue. Life is good. He himself has the Times crossword open in front of him, and although he's filled in a few squares, it's mostly a defensive measure. He doesn't like to talk to people on the train, doesn't like loose conversation of any sort, and the last thing in the world he wants is a commuter buddy. When he starts seeing the same faces in any given car, when people start to nod to him or say, "How you doing today?" as they go to their seats, he changes cars. It's not that hard to remain unknown, just another commuter from suburban Connecticut, a man conspicuous only in his adamant refusal to wear a red tie. Maybe he was once a parochial school boy. Maybe once he held a weeping little girl while one of his friends struck her repeatedly with a baseball bat. And maybe he once spent time in the green. Nobody on the train has to know these things. That's the good thing about trains. "All ready for Christmas?" the man in the aisle seat asks him. He looks up, almost frowning, then decides it's not a substantive remark, only the sort of empty time passer some people seem to feel compelled to make. The man beside him is fat and will undoubtedly stink by noon, no matter how much speed stick he used this morning, but he's hardly even looking at Bill, so that's all right. "Yes, well, you know," he says, looking down at the briefcase between his shoes, the briefcase that contains a ball of tinsel and nothing else. "I'm getting in the spirit, little by little." 8:40 a.m. He comes out of Grand Central with 1,000 other top-coated men and women, mid-level executives for the most part, sleek gerbils who will be running full tilt on their exercise wheels by noon. He stands still for a moment, breathing deep of the cold gray air. Lexington Avenue is dressed in its Christmas lights, and a little distance away, a Santa Claus who looks Puerto Rican is ringing a bell. He's got a pot for contributions with an easel set up beside it. "Help the homeless this Christmas," the sign on the easel says, and the man in the blue tie thinks, "How about a little truth in advertising, Santa? How about a sign that says, 'Help me support my coke habit this Christmas'?" Nevertheless, he drops a couple of dollar bills into the pot as he walks past. He has a good feeling about today. He's glad Sharon reminded him of the tinsel. He would have forgotten to bring it, probably. In the end, he always forgets stuff like that. The grace notes. A walk of 10 minutes takes him to his building. Standing outside the door is a black youth, maybe 17, wearing black jeans and a dirty red hooded sweatshirt. He jives from foot to foot, blowing puffs of steam out of his mouth, smiling frequently, showing a gold tooth. In one hand, he holds a partly crushed styrofoam coffee cup. There's some change in it, which he rattles constantly.
"Spare a little?" he asks the passers-by as they stream toward the revolving doors. "Spare me a little, sir? Spare me just a little, ma'am? Just trying to get a spot of breakfast, thank you. God bless you. Merry Christmas. Spare a little, my man. Quarter, maybe, thank you. Spare a little, ma'am?"
As he passes, Bill drops a nickel and 2 dimes into the young black man's cup.
"Thank you, sir. God bless. Merry Christmas."
"You too," he says. The woman next to him frowns. "You shouldn't encourage them," she says. He gives her a shrug and a small, shame-faced smile. "It's hard for me to say no to anyone at Christmas," he tells her. He enters the lobby with a stream of others, stares briefly after the opinionated bitch as she heads for the newsstand, then goes to the elevators with their old-fashioned floor dials and their Art Deco numbers. Here, several people nod to him, and he exchanges a few words with a couple of them as they wait. It's not like the train, after all, where you can change cars. Plus, the building is an old one. The elevators are slow and cranky.
"How's the wife, Bill?"
a scrawny, constantly grinning man from the 5th floor asks.
"Carol's fine,"
Kids?
Both good. He has no kids, and his wife's name isn't Carol. His wife is the former Sharon Ann Donahue, St. Gabriel the Steadfast Secondary Parochial School, class of 1964, but that's something the scrawny, constantly grinning man will never know.
Bet they can't wait for the big day,
the scrawny man says, his grin widening and becoming something unspeakable. To Bill Shearman, he looks like an editorial cartoonist's conception of death, all big eyes and huge teeth and stretched, shiny skin. That grin makes him think of Tamboy in the Ashau Valley. Those guys from 2nd Battalion went in looking like the kings of the world and came out looking like singed escapees from Hell's Half Acre. They came out with those big eyes and huge teeth. They still look like that in Dong Ha, where they all got kind of mixed together a few days later. A lot of mixing together went on in the bush. A lot of shake and bake, too. Absolutely can't wait, he agrees. But I think Sarah's getting kind of suspicious about the guy in the red suit. Hurry up, elevator, he thinks. Jesus, save me from these stupidities. Yeah, it happens, the scrawny man says. His grin fades for a moment, as if they were discussing cancer instead of Santa. How old's Sarah now?
8.
Seems like she was just born a year ago. Boy, the time sure flies when you're having fun, doesn't it?
You can say that again, he says, fervently hoping the scrawny man won't say it again.
At that moment, one of the four elevators finally gasps open its doors, and they herd themselves inside. Bill and the scrawny man walk a little way down the fifth-floor hall together, and then the scrawny man stops in front of a set of old-fashioned double doors with the words, Consolidated Insurance, written on one frosted glass panel, and Adjusters of America on the other. From behind these doors comes the muted clickety-clack of keyboards and the slightly louder sound of ringing phones.
Have a good day, Bill.
You too. The scrawny man lets himself into his office, and for a moment Bill sees a big wreath hung on the far side of the room. Also, the windows have been decorated with the kind of snow that comes in a spray can. He shudders and thinks, God save us, everyone. 9:05 a.m. His office, one of two he keeps in this building, is at the far end of the hall. The two offices closest to it are dark and vacant, a situation that has held for the last 6 months and one he likes just fine. Printed on the frosted glass of his own office door are the words, Western States Land Analysts. There are three locks on the door, the one that was on when he moved into the building, plus two he has put on himself. He lets himself in, closes the door, turns the bolt, then engages the police lock. A desk stands in the center of the room, and it is cluttered with papers, but none of them mean anything. They are simply window dressing for the cleaning service. Every so often he throws them all out and redistributes a fresh batch. In the center of the desk is a telephone on which he makes occasional random calls so that the phone company won't register the line as totally inactive. Last year he purchased a copier, and it looks very businesslike over in its corner by the door to the office's little second room, but it has never been used. Do you hear what I hear? Do you smell what I smell? Do you taste what I taste? He murmurs, and crosses to the door leading to the second room. Inside are shelves stacked high with more meaningless paper, two large file cabinets. There is a Walkman on top of one, his excuse on the few occasions when someone knocks on the locked door and gets no answer, a chair, and a stepladder. Bill takes the stepladder back to the main room and unfolds it to the left of the desk. He puts his briefcase on top of it. Then he mounts the first three steps of the ladder, reaches up, the bottom half of his coat bells out and around his legs as he does, and carefully moves aside one of the suspended ceiling panels.
Above is a dark area which cannot quite be called a utility space, although a few pipes and wires do run through it. There's no dust up here, at least not in this immediate area, and no rodent droppings either. He uses Decon Mouseproof once a month. He wants to keep his clothes nice as he goes back and forth, of course, but that's not really the important part. The important part is to respect your work and your field. This he learned in the Army during his time in the Green, and he sometimes thinks it is the second most important thing he's ever learned in his life. The most important is that only penance replaces confession, and only penance defines identity. This is a lesson he began learning in 1960 when he was 14. That was the last year he could go into the booth and say, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," and then tell everything. Penance is important to him. God bless, he thinks there in the stale, smelling darkness of the utility space. God bless you, God bless me, God bless us everyone. Above this narrow space, a ghostly gentle wind hoots endlessly through it, bringing a smell of dust and the groan of the elevators. It is the bottom of the sixth floor, and here is a square trapdoor about 30 inches on a side. Bill installed it himself. He's handy with tools, which is one of the things Sharon appreciates about him. He flips the trapdoor up, letting in muted light from above, then grabs his briefcase by the handle. As he sticks his head into the space between floors, water rushes gustily down the fat bathroom conduit 20 or 30 feet north of his present position. An hour from now, when the people in the building start their coffee breaks, that sound will be as constant and as rhythmic as waves breaking on a beach. Bill hardly notices this or any of the other interfloor sounds. He's used to them. He climbs carefully to the top of the stepladder, then boosts himself through into his sixth floor office, leaving Bill down on 5. Up here, he is Willie again, just as he was in high school, just as he was in Vietnam, where he was sometimes known as Baseball Willie. This upper office has a sturdy workshop look, with coils and motors and vents stacked neatly on metal shelves, and what looks like a filter of some kind squatting on one corner of the desk. It is an office, however. There's a typewriter, a dictaphone, an in-out basket full of papers, also window dressing, which he periodically rotates like a farmer rotating crops, and file cabinets, lots of file cabinets. On one wall is a Norman Rockwell painting of a family praying over Thanksgiving dinner. Behind the desk is a framed studio portrait of Willie in his first lieutenant's uniform, taken in Saigon shortly before he won his Silver Star for action at the site of the helicopter crash outside of Dong Ha. And next to it is a blow-up of his honorable discharge, also framed. The name on the sheet is William Shearman, and here his decorations are duly noted. He saved Sullivan's life on the trail outside the ville. The citation accompanying the Silver Star says so. The men who survived Dong Ha said so. And more important than either of those, Sullivan said so. It's the first thing he said when they wound up in San Francisco together at the hospital known as the Pussy Palace. "You saved my life, man." Willie sitting on Sullivan's bed, Willie with one arm still bandaged and salve all around his eyes, but really okay. Yeah, he was cruising. It was Sullivan who had been badly hurt. That was the day the AP photographer took their picture, the photo that appeared in newspapers all over the country, including the Harwich Journal. "He took my hand," Willie thinks, as he stands there in his sixth floor office, with Bill Shearman now a floor down. Above the studio portrait and his discharge is a poster from the 60s. This item, not framed and starting to yellow at the edges, shows the peace sign. Below it, in red, white, and blue, is this punchline, "Track of the Great American Chicken." "He took my hand," he thinks again. Yes, Sullivan had done that, and Willie had come within an ace of leaping to his feet and running back down the ward, screaming. He had been positive that Sullivan would say,
I know what you did, you and your friends Doolin and O'Meara. Did you think she wouldn't tell me?
Sullivan had said nothing like that. What he'd said was, you saved my life, man. From the old hometown, and you saved my life. Shit, what are the odds? And we used to be so scared of the boys from St. Gabe's. When he said that, Willie had known for sure that Sullivan had no idea of what Doolin, O'Meara, and he had done to Carol Gerber. There was no relief in knowing he was safe, however. None. And as he smiled and squeezed Sullivan's hand, he had thought, you were right to be scared, Sully. You were right to be. Willie puts Bill's briefcase on the desk, then lies down on his stomach. He pokes his head and arms into the windy, oil-smelling darkness between floors and replaces the ceiling panel of the fifth-floor office. It's locked up tight. He doesn't expect anyone anyway. He never does. Western States Land Analysts has never had a single customer. But it's better to be safe. Always safe, never sorry. With his fifth-floor office set to rights, Willie lowers the trapdoor in this one. Up here, the trap is hidden by a small rug, which is superglued to the wood, so it can go up and down without too much flopping or sliding around. He gets to his feet, dusts off his hands, then turns to the briefcase and opens it. He takes out the ball of tinsel and puts it on top of the dictaphone, which stands on the desk. Good one, he says, thinking again that Sharon can be a real peach when she sets her mind to it. And she often does. He relatches the briefcase and then begins to undress, doing it carefully and methodically, reversing the steps he took at 6:30, running the film backward. He strips off everything, even his undershorts and his black knee-high socks. Naked, he hangs his topcoat, suit jacket, and shirt carefully in the closet, where only one other item hangs. A heavy red jacket, not quite thick enough to be termed a parka. Below it is a box-like thing, a little too bulky to be termed a briefcase. Willie puts his Mark Cross case next to it, then places his slacks in the pants press, taking pains with the crease. The tie goes on the rack screwed to the back of the closet door, where it hangs all by itself like a long blue tongue. He pads barefoot naked across to one of the file cabinet stacks. On top of it is an ashtray embossed with a pissed-off-looking eagle and the words, If I Die in a Combat Zone. In the ashtray are a pair of dog tags on a chain. Willie slips the chain over his head, then slides out the bottom drawer of the cabinet stack. Inside are underclothes. Neatly folded on top are a pair of khaki boxer shorts. He slips them on. Next come white athletic socks, followed by a white cotton t-shirt, round neck, not strappy. The shapes of his dog tags stand out against it, as do his biceps and quads. They aren't as good as they were in A Shao and Dong Ha, but they aren't bad for a guy who is closing in on 40. Now, before he finishes dressing, it is time for penance. He goes to another stack of cabinets and rolls out the second drawer. He thumbs rapidly through the bound ledgers there, passing those from late 1982, then thumbing through those from this year, January through April, May through June, July, August. He always feels compelled to write more in the summer. September through October, and at last the current volume, November through December. He sits at his desk, opens the ledger, and flicks rapidly through pages of densely packed writing. There are small variations in the writing, but the essence is always the same. I am heartily sorry. He only writes for 10 minutes or so this morning, pen scratching busily, sticking to the basic fact of the matter. I am heartily sorry. He has, to the best of his reckoning, written this over 2 million times, and is just getting started. Confession would be quicker, but he is willing to take the long way around. He finishes, no, he never finishes, but he finishes for today, and puts the current ledger back between those finished and all those yet to be filled.
Then he returns to the stack of file cabinets, which serve as his chest of drawers. As he opens the one above his socks and skivvies, he begins to hum under his breath, not, "Do you hear what I hear?" but "The Doors," the one about how the day destroys the night divides the day. He slips on a plain blue chambray shirt, then a pair of fatigue pants. He rolls this middle drawer back in and opens the top one. Here there is a scrapbook and a pair of boots. He takes the scrapbook out and looks at its red leather cover for a moment. The word "Memories" is stamped on the front in flaking gold. It's a cheap thing, this book. He could afford better, but you don't always have a right to what you can afford. In the summer, he writes more sorries, but memory seems to sleep. It is in winter, especially around Christmas, that memory awakens. Then he wants to look in this book, which is full of clippings and photos where everyone looks impossibly young. Today, he puts the scrapbook back into the drawer unopened and takes out the boots. They are polished to a high sheen and look as if they might last until the Trump of Judgment, maybe even longer. They aren't standard Army issue, not these. These are jump boots, 101st Airborne stuff, but that's all right. He isn't actually trying to dress like a soldier. If he wanted to dress like a soldier, he would. Still, there is no more reason to look sloppy than there is to allow dust to collect in the pass-through, and he's careful about the way he dresses. He does not tuck his pants into his boots, of course. He is headed for Fifth Avenue in December, not the Mekong in August. Snakes and poppy bugs are not apt to be a problem. But he intends to look squared away. Looking good is as important to him as it is to Bill, maybe even more important. Respecting one's work and one's field begins, after all, with respecting oneself. The last two items are in the back of the top drawer of his bureau stack, a tube of makeup and a jar of hair gel. He squeezes some of the makeup into the palm of his left hand, then begins applying it, working from forehead to the base of his neck. He moves with the unconcerned speed of long experience, giving himself a moderate tan. With that done, he works some of the gel into his hair and then recombs it, getting rid of the part and sweeping it straight back from his forehead. It is the last touch, the smallest touch, and perhaps the most telling touch. There is no trace of the commuter who walked out of Grand Central an hour ago. The man in the mirror mounted on the back of the door to the small storage annex looks like a washed-up mercenary. There is a kind of silent, half-humbled pride in the tanned face, something people won't look at too long. It hurts them if they do. Willie knows this is so. He has seen it. He doesn't ask why it should be so. He has made himself a life pretty much without questions, and that's the way he likes it. "All right," he says, closing the door to the storage room. "Looking good, Trooper." He goes back to the closet for the red jacket, which is the reversible type, and the boxy case. He slips the jacket over his desk chair for the time being and puts the case on the desk. He unlatches it and swings the top up on sturdy hinges. Now it looks a little like the cases street salesmen use to display their knockoff watches and questionable gold chains. There are only a few items in Willie's, one of them broken down into two pieces so it will fit. There is a sign. There is a pair of gloves, the kind you wear in cold weather, and a third glove, which he used to wear when it was warm. He takes out the pair. He will want them today, no doubt about that. And then the sign on its length of stout cord. The cord has been knotted through holes in the cardboard at either side so Willie can hang the sign around his neck. He closes the case again, not bothering to latch it, and puts the sign on top of it. The desk is so cluttery, it's the only good surface he has to work on. Humming, "We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there," he opens the wide drawer above the knee hole, paws past the pencils and chapsticks and paper clips and memo pads, and finally finds his stapler. He then unrolls the ball of tinsel, placing it carefully around the rectangle of his sign. He snips off the extra and staples the shiny stuff firmly into place. He holds it up for a moment, first assessing the effect, then admiring it. "Perfect,"
he says. The telephone rings, and he stiffens, turning to look at it with eyes which are suddenly very small and hard and totally alert. One ring. Two. Three. On the fourth, the machine kicks in, answering in his voice, the version of it that goes with this office, anyway. "Hi, you've reached Midtown Heating and Cooling," Willie Shearman says. "No one can take your call right now, so leave a message at the beep." Beep. He listens tensely, standing over his just-decorated sign with his hands balled into fists. "Hi, this is Ed from the 9X Yellow Pages," the voice from the machine says. And Willie lets out a breath he hasn't known he was holding. His hands begin to loosen. "Please have your company rep call me at 1-800-555-1000 for information on how you can increase your ad space in both versions of the Yellow Pages and at the same time save big money on your yearly bill. Happy holidays to all. Thanks." Click. Willie looks at the answering machine a moment longer, almost as if he expects it to speak again, to threaten him, perhaps to accuse him of all the crimes of which he accuses himself. But nothing happens. "Squared away," he murmurs, putting the decorated sign back into the case. This time, when he closes it, he latches it. Across the front is a bumper sticker, its message flanked by small American flags. "I was proud to serve," it reads. "Squared away, baby. You better believe it." He leaves the office, closing the door with Midtown Heating and Cooling printed on the frosted glass panel behind him, and turning all three of the locks.
"9:45 a.m. Halfway down the hall, he sees Ralph Williamson, one of the tubby accountants from Gerowitz Financial Planning. All the accountants at Gerowitz are tubby, from what Willie has been able to observe. There's a key chained to an old wooden panel in one of Ralph's pink hands, and from this, Willie deduces that he is looking at an accountant in need of a wee. Key on a paddle. If a fucking key on a fucking paddle won't make you remember the joys of parochial school, remember all those hairy-chinned nuns and all those knuckle-whacking wooden rulers, then nothing will, he thinks. And you know what? Ralph Williamson probably likes having that key on a paddle, just like he likes having a soap on a rope in the shape of a bunny rabbit or a circus clown hanging from the hot faucet in his shower at home. And so what if he does? Judge not, lest ye be fucking judged. "Hey, Ralphie, what's doing?" Ralph turns, sees Willie, brightens. "Hey, hi, Merry Christmas." Willie grins at the look in Ralph's eyes. Tubby little fucker worships him, and why not? Ralph is looking at a guy so squared away it hurts. "Gotta like it, sweetheart. Gotta like that." "Same to you, bro." He holds out his hand, now gloved, so he doesn't have to worry about it being too white, not matching his face. Palm up. "Gimme 5. Smiling shyly, Ralph does. "Gimme 10. Ralph turns his pink, pudgy hand over and allows Willie to slap it. "So goddamn good, I gotta do it again," Willie exclaims and gives Ralph 5 more. "Got your Christmas shopping done, Ralphie?" "Almost," Ralph says, grinning and jingling the bathroom key. "Yes, almost. How about you, Willie?" Willie tips him a wink. "Ah, you know how it is, brother man. I got 2-3 women, and I just let each of them buy me a little keepsake." Ralph's admiring smile suggests he does not, in fact, know how it is, but rather wishes he did. "Got a service call? A whole day's worth. 'Tis the season, you know." "Seems like it's always the season for you. Business must be good. You're hardly ever in your office." "That's why God gave us answering machines, Ralphie. You better go on now, or you're going to be dealing with a wet spot on your best gabardine slacks." Laughing, blushing a little too, Ralph heads for the men's room. Willie goes on down to the elevators, carrying his case in hand and checking to make sure his glasses are still in his jacket pocket with the other. They are. The envelope is in there, too, thick and crackling with $20 bills. 15 of them. It's time for a little visit from Officer Wheelock. Willie expected him yesterday. Maybe he won't show until tomorrow, but Willie is betting on today. Not that he likes it. He knows it's the way of the world. You have to grease the wheels if you want your wagon to roll, but he still has a resentment. There are lots of days when he thinks about how pleasant it would be to put a bullet in Jasper Wheelock's head. It was the way things happened in the Green sometimes, the way things had to happen. That thing with Malenfant, for instance. That crazy motherfucker, him with his pimples and his deck of cards. Oh, yes. In the bush, things were different. In the bush, you sometimes had to do something wrong to prevent an even greater wrong. Behavior like that shows you're in the wrong place to start with, no doubt. But once you're in the soup, you just have to swim. He and his men from Bravo Company were only with the Delta Company boys a few days, so Willie didn't have much experience with Malenfant. But his shrill, grating voice is hard to forget. And he remembers something Malenfant would yell during his endless hearts games if someone tried to take back a card after it was laid down. No way, fuckwad. Once it's laid, it's played. Malenfant might have been an asshole, but he had been right about that. In life as well as in cards, once it's laid, it's played. The elevator doesn't stop on 5, but the thought of that happening no longer makes him nervous. He has ridden down to the lobby many times with people who work on the same floor as Bill Shearman, including the scrawny drink of water from Consolidated Insurance, and they don't recognize him. They should. He knows they should, but they don't. He used to think it was the change of clothes and the makeup. Then he decided it was the hair. But in his heart, he knows that none of those things can account for it. Not even their numb-hearted insensitivity to the world they live in can account for it. What he's doing just isn't that radical. Fatigue pants, billy hop boots, and a little brown makeup don't make a disguise. No way do they make a disguise. He doesn't know exactly how to explain it, and so mostly leaves it alone. He learned this technique, as he learned so many others, in Vietnam. The young black man is still standing outside the lobby door. He's flipped up the hood of his grungy old sweatshirt now, and he shakes his crumpled styrofoam cup at Willie. He sees that the dude carrying the Mr. Repairman case in one hand is smiling, and so his own smile widens. "Spare a little?" he asks Mr. Repairman. "What do you say, my man?" "Get the fuck out of my way, you lazy dickhead. That's what I say," Willie tells him, still smiling. The young man falls back a step, looking at Willie with wide, shocked eyes. Before he can think of anything to say, Mr. Repairman is halfway down the block and almost lost in the throngs of shoppers, his big, blocky case swinging from one gloved hand. 10 o'clock a.m. He goes into the Whitmore Hotel, crosses the lobby, and takes the escalator up to the mezzanine, where the public restrooms are. This is the only part of the day he ever feels nervous about, and he can't say why. Certainly nothing has ever happened before, during, or after one of his hotel bathroom stops. He rotates among roughly 2 dozen of them in the Midtown area. Still, he is somehow certain that if things do turn dinky dow on him, it will happen in a hotel shithouse. Because what happens next is not like transforming from Bill Shearman to Willie Shearman. Bill and Willie are brothers, perhaps even fraternal twins, and the switch from one to the other feels clean and perfectly normal. The workday's final transformation, however, from Willie Shearman to blind Willie Garfield, has never felt that way. The last change always feels murky, furtive, almost werewolfy. Until it's done, and he's on the street again, tapping his white cane in front of him, he feels as a snake must after it shed its old skin and before the new one works in and grows tough. He looks around and sees the men's bathroom is empty, except for a pair of feet under the door of the second stall in a long row of them. There must be a dozen in all. A throat clears softly. A newspaper rattles. There is a pfft sound of a polite little midtown fart. Willie goes all the way to the last stall in line. He puts down his case, latches the door shut, and takes off his red jacket. He turns it inside out as he does so, reversing it. The other side is olive green. It has become an old soldier's field jacket with a single pull of the arms. Sharon, who really does have a touch of genius, bought this side of his coat in an army surplus store and tore out the lining so she could sew it easily into the red jacket. Before sewing, however, she put a first lieutenant's badge on it, plus black strips of cloth where the name and unit slugs would have gone. She then washed the garment 30 times or so. The badge and the unit markings are gone now, of course, but the places where they were stand out clearly. The cloth is greener on the sleeves and the left breast, fresher in patterns any veteran of the armed services must recognize at once. Willie hangs the coat on the hook, drops trowel, sits, then picks up his case and settles it on his thighs. He opens it, takes out the disassembled cane, and quickly screws the two pieces together. Holding it far down the shaft, he reaches up from his sitting position and hooks the handle over the top of his jacket. Then he relatches the case, pulls a little paper off the roll in order to create the proper business is finished sound effect, probably unnecessary, but always safe, never sorry, and flushes the john. Before stepping out of the stall, he takes the glasses from the jacket pocket, which also holds the payoff envelope. They're big wraparounds, retro shades he associates with lava lamps, an outlaw biker movie starring Peter Fonda. They're good for business, though, partly because they somehow say veteran to people, and partly because no one can peek in at his eyes, even from the sides. Willie Shearman stays behind in the mezzanine restroom of the Whitmore, just as Bill Shearman stays behind in the fifth-floor office of Western States Land Analysts. The man who comes out, a man wearing an old fatigue jacket, shades, and tapping a white cane lightly before him, is Blind Willie, a Fifth Avenue fixture since the days of Gerald Ford. As he crosses the small mezzanine lobby toward the stairs, unaccompanied blind men never use escalators, he sees a woman in a red blazer coming toward him. With the heavily tinted lenses between them, she looks like some sort of exotic fish swimming in muddy water. And, of course, it is not just the glasses. By 2 this afternoon, he really will be blind, just as he kept screaming he was when he and John Sullivan and God knows how many others were medevaced out of Dongha province back in 70. "I'm blind," he was yelling it, even as he picked Sullivan up off the path, but he hadn't been exactly. Through the throbbing post-flash whiteness, he had seen Sullivan rolling around and trying to hold his bulging guts in. He had picked Sullivan up and ran with him, clasped clumsily over one shoulder. Sullivan was bigger than Willie, a lot bigger, and Willie had no idea how he could possibly have carried such a weight, but somehow he had, all the way to the clearing where Huey's like God's mercy had taken them off. "God bless you, Huey's. God bless. Oh, God bless you, every one." He had run to the clearing in the copters with bullets whicking all around him and body parts made in America lying on the trail where the mine or the booby trap or whatever the fuck it was had gone off. "I'm blind," he had screamed, carrying Sullivan, feeling Sullivan's blood drenching his uniform, and Sullivan had been screaming too. If Sullivan had stopped screaming, would Willie have simply rolled the man off his shoulder and gone on alone, trying to outrun the ambush? Probably not. Because by then he knew who Sullivan was, exactly who he was. He was Sully from the old hometown, Sully who had gone out with Carol Gerber from the old hometown. "I'm blind, I'm blind, I'm blind." That's what Willie Shearman was screaming as he toted Sullivan, and it's true that much of the world was blast white, but he still remembers seeing bullets twitch through leaves and thud into the trunks of trees. remembers seeing one of the men who had been in the ville earlier that day clap his hand to his throat. He remembers seeing the blood come bursting through that man's fingers in a flood, drenching his uniform. One of the other men from Delta Company 2-2, Pagano his name had been, grabbed this fellow around the middle and hustled him past the staggering Willie Shearman, who really couldn't see very much, screaming, "I'm blind, I'm blind, I'm blind," and smelling Sullivan's blood, the stink of it. And in the copter, that whiteness had started to come on strong. His face was burned, his hair was burned, his scalp was burned, the world was white. He was scorched and smoking, just one more escapee from Hell's Half Acre. He had believed he would never see again, and that had actually been a relief. But of course he had. In time, he had. The woman in the red blazer has reached him. "Can I help you, sir?" she asks.
"No, ma'am," Blind Willie says.
The ceaselessly moving cane stops tapping floor and quests over emptiness. It pendulums back and forth, mapping the sides of the staircase. Blind Willie nods, then moves carefully but confidently forward until he can touch the railing with the hand which holds the bulky case. He switches the case to his cane hand so he can grasp the railing, then turns toward the woman. He's careful not to smile directly at her, but a little to her left.
"No, thank you. I'm fine. Merry Christmas."
He starts downstairs, tapping ahead of him as he goes, big case held easily in spite of the cane. It's light, almost empty. Later, of course, it will be a different story. AM. Fifth Avenue is decked out for the holiday season. Glitter and finery he can barely see. Street lamps wear garlands of holly. The big stores have become garish Christmas packages, complete with gigantic red bows. A wreath, which must be 40 feet across, graces the staid beige facade of Brooks Brothers. Lights twinkle everywhere. In Saks' show window, a high-fashion mannequin, haughty fuck-you-jack expression, almost no tits or hips, sits astride a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. She is wearing a Santa hat, a fur-trimmed motorcycle jacket, thigh-high boots, and nothing else. Silver bells hang from the cycle's handlebars. Somewhere nearby, carolers are singing Silent Night. Not exactly Blind Willie's favorite tune, but a good deal better than Do You Hear What I Hear? He stops where he always stops, in front of St. Patrick's, across the street from Saks, allowing the package-laden shoppers to flood past in front of him. His movements now are simple and dignified. His discomfort in the men's room, that feeling of gawky nakedness about to be exposed, has passed. He never feels more Catholic than when he arrives on this spot. He was a St. Gabe's boy, after all. Wore the cross, wore the surplice, and took his turn as altar boy. Knelt in the booth. Ate the hated haddock on Fridays. He is in many ways still a St. Gabe's boy. All three versions of him have that in common. That part crossed the years and got over, as they used to say. Only these days he does penance instead of confession, and his certainty of heaven is gone. These days all he can do is hope. He squats, unlatches the case, and turns it so those approaching from uptown will be able to read the sticker on the top. Next, he takes out the third glove, the baseball glove he has had since the summer of 1960. He puts the glove beside the case. Nothing breaks more hearts than a blind man with a baseball glove, he has found. God bless America. Last but not least, he takes out the sign with its brave skirting of tinsel and ducks under the string. The sign comes to rest against the front of his field jacket. William J. Garfield, former U.S. Army, served Quang Tri, Toa Tien, Tam Boy, Ah Shao.
Lost my sight, Donghua Province, 1970. Robbed of benefits by a grateful government, 1973. Lost home, 1975. Ashamed to beg, but have a son in school. Think well of me if you can. He raises his head so that the white light of this cold, almost ready to snow day slides across the blind bulbs of his dark glasses. Now the work begins, and it is harder work than anyone will ever know. There is a way to stand, not quite the military posture which is called parade rest, but close to it. The head must stay up, looking both at and through the people who pass back and forth in their thousands and tens of thousands. The hands must hang straight down in their black gloves, never fiddling with the sign or with the fabric of his pants or with each other. He must continue to project that sense of hurt, humbled pride. There must be no sense of shame or shaming, and most of all, no taint of insanity. He never speaks unless spoken to, and only then when he is spoken to in kindness. He does not respond to people who ask him angrily why he doesn't get a real job, or what he means about being robbed of his benefits. He does not argue with those who accuse him of fakery, or speak scornfully of a son who would allow his father to put him through school by begging on a street corner. He remembers breaking this ironclad rule only once, on a sweltering summer afternoon in 1981. "What school does your son go to?" a woman asked him angrily. He doesn't know what she looked like. By then it was 4 o'clock, and he had been as blind as a bat for at least 2 hours. But he had felt anger exploding out of her in all directions, like bedbugs exiting an old mattress. In a way, she had reminded him of Malenfant with his shrill, "You can't not hear it," voice. "Tell me which one. I want to mail him a dog turd."
"Don't bother," he replied, turning toward the sound of her voice. "If you've got a dog turd you want to mail somewhere, send it to LBJ. Federal Express must deliver to hell. They deliver every place else."
"God bless you, man," a guy in a cashmere overcoat says, and his voice trembles with surprising emotion, except blind Willie Garfield isn't surprised. He's heard it all, he reckons, and a bit more. A surprising number of his customers put their money carefully and reverently in the pocket of the baseball glove. The guy in the cashmere coat drops his contribution into the open case, however, where it properly belongs. A 5. The workday has begun. AM. So far, so good. He lays his cane down carefully, drops to one knee, and dumps the contents of the baseball glove into the box. Then he sweeps a hand back and forth through the bills, although he can still see them pretty well. He picks them up. There's $400 or $500 in all, which puts him on the way to a $3,000 day. Not great for this time of year, but not bad either. Then rolls them up and slips a rubber band around them. He then pushes a button on the inside of the case, and the false floor drops down on springs, dumping the load of change all the way to the bottom. He adds the roll of bills, making no attempt to hide what he's doing, but feeling no qualms about it either. In all the years he has been doing this, no one has ever taken him off. God help the asshole whoever tries. He lets go of the button, allowing the false floor to snap back into place, and stands up. A hand immediately presses into the small of his back. "Merry Christmas, Willie," the owner of the hand says. Blind Willie recognizes him by the smell of his cologne. "Merry Christmas, Officer Wheelock," Willie responds. His head remains tilted upward in a faintly questioning posture. His hands hang at his sides. His feet, in their brightly polished boots, remain apart in a stance not quite wide enough to be parade rest, but nowhere near tight enough to pass as attention. "How are you today, sir?" "In the pink, motherfucker," Wheelock says. "You know me. Always in the pink." Here comes a man in a top coat hanging open over a bright red ski sweater. His hair is short, black on top, gray on the sides. His face has a stern, carved look. Blind Willie recognizes at once. He's got a couple of handle-top bags, one from Saks, one from Bally, in his hands. He stops and reads the sign. "Dong Ha?" he asks suddenly, speaking not as a man does when naming a place, but as one does when recognizing an old acquaintance on a busy street.
"Yes, sir," Blind Willie says. "Who is your CO?
"Captain Bob Brissom, with a U, not an O, and above him, Colonel Andrew Shelf, sir."
"I heard of Shelf," says the man in the open coat.
His face suddenly looks different. As he walked toward the man on the corner, it looked as if it belonged on Fifth Avenue. Now it doesn't.
"Never met him, though?"
"Toward the end of my run, we didn't see anyone with much rank, sir."
"If you came out of the Ashau Valley, I'm not surprised. Are we on the same page here, soldier?"
"Yes, sir. There wasn't much command structure left by the time we hit Dong Ha. I pretty much rolled things along with another lieutenant. His name was Diefenbaker." The man in the red ski sweater is nodding slowly.
"You boys were there when those helicopters came down, if I've got this placed right."
"That's affirmative, sir."
"Then you must have been there later when..."
Blind Willie does not help him finish. He can smell Wheelock's cologne, though, stronger than ever, and the man is practically panting in his ear, sounding like a horny kid at the end of a hot date. Wheelock has never bought his act, and although Blind Willie pays for the privilege of being left alone on this corner, and quite handsomely by going rates, he knows that part of Wheelock is still cop enough to hope he'll fuck up. Part of Wheelock is actively rooting for that. But the Wheelocks of the world never understand that what looks fake isn't always fake. Sometimes the issues are a little more complicated than they appear at first glance. That was something else Vietnam had to teach him back in the years before it became a political joke and a crutch for hack film writers.
69 and 70 were the hard years, the graying man says.
He speaks in a slow, heavy voice.
I was at Hamburger Hill with the 3-187, so I know the Ah Shao and Tam Boy.
Do you remember Route 922?
Yes, sir, Glory Road, Blind Willie says. I lost two friends there.
Glory Road, the man in the open coat says, and all at once he looks 1,000 years old, the bright red ski sweater an obscenity, like something hung on a museum mummy by cut-up kids who believe they are exhibiting a sense of humor. His eyes are off over 100 horizons. Then they come back here to this street where a nearby carillon is playing the one that goes, "I hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring-ting-tingling, too." He sets his bags down between his expensive shoes and takes a pigskin wallet out from an inner pocket. He opens it, riffles through a neat thickness of bills.
"Son all right, Garfield?" he asks. "Making good grades?"
"Yes, sir."
"How old?"
15, sir."
"Public school?"
"Parochial, sir."
"Excellent. And God willing, he'll never see Glory fucking Road."
The man in the open topcoat takes a bill out of his wallet. Blind Willie feels as well as hears Wheelock's little gasp, and hardly has to look at the bill to know it is 100.
"Yes, sir, that's affirmative, God willing."
The man in the topcoat touches Willie's hand with the bill, looks surprised when the gloved hand pulls back, as if it were bare and had been touched by something hot. "Put it in my case or my ball glove, sir, if you would," Blind Willie says. The man in the top coat looks at him for a moment, eyebrows raised, frowning slightly, then seems to understand. He stoops, puts the bill in the ancient oiled pocket of the glove with Garfield printed in blue ink on the side, then reaches into his front pocket and brings out a small handful of change. This he scatters across the face of old Ben Franklin in order to hold the bill down. Then he stands up. His eyes are wet and bloodshot.
"Do you any good to give you my card?" he asks Blind Willie. "I can put you in touch with several veterans organizations."
"Thank you, sir. I'm sure you could, but I must respectfully decline."
"Tried most of them?"
"Tried some, yes, sir."
"Where'd you VA?"
San Francisco, sir. He hesitates, then adds, the Pussy Palace, sir. The man in the top coat laughs heartily at this, and when his face crinkles, the tears which have been standing in his eyes run down his weathered cheeks. Pussy Palace, he cries. I haven't heard that in 10 years. A bedpan under every bed and a naked nurse between every set of sheets, right? Naked except for the love beads, which they left on.
Yes, sir, that about covers it, sir.
Or uncovers it. Merry Christmas, soldier.
The man in the top coat ticks off a little one-finger salute. Merry Christmas to you, sir. The man in the top coat picks up his bags again and walks off. He doesn't look back. Blind Willie would not have seen him do so if he had. His vision is now down to ghosts and shadows.
That was beautiful, Wheelock murmurs.
The feeling of Wheelock's freshly used air puffing into the cup of his ear is hateful to Blind Willie, gruesome, in fact. But he will not give the man the pleasure of moving his head so much as an inch.
The old fuck was actually crying, as I'm sure you saw. But you can talk the talk, Willie. I'll give you that much.
Willie says nothing. Some VA hospital called the Pussy Palace, huh? Wheelock asks. Sounds like my kind of place. Where'd you read about it, Soldier of Fortune? The shadow of a woman, a dark shape in a darkening day, bends over the open case and drops something in. A gloved hand touches Willie's gloved hand and squeezes briefly. God bless you, my friend, she says. Thank you, ma'am. The shadow moves off. The little puffs of breath in Blind Willie's ear do not.
You got something for me, pal? Wheelock asks.
Blind Willie reaches into his jacket pocket. He produces the envelope and holds it out, jabbing the chilly air with it. It is snatched from his fingers as soon as Wheelock can track it down and get hold of it.
You asshole!
There's fear as well as anger in the cop's voice.
How many times have I told you? Palm it! Palm it!
Blind Willie says nothing. He is thinking of the baseball glove, how he erased Bobby Garfield, as well as you could erase ink from leather anyway, and then printed Willie Shearman's name in its place. Later, after Vietnam and just as he was starting his new career, he erased a second time and printed a single name, Garfield, in big block letters. The place on the side of the old Alvin dark glove where all these changes have been made looks flayed and raw. If he thinks of the glove, if he concentrates on that scuffed place and its layer of names, he can probably keep from doing something stupid. That's what Wheelock wants, of course. What he wants a lot more than his shitty little payoff, for Willie to do something stupid, to give himself away. How much? Wheelock asks after a moment.
$300, Blind Willie says. $300, Officer Wheelock.
This is greeted by a little thinking silence, but Wheelock takes a step back from Blind Willie, and the puffs of breath in his ear diffuse a little. Blind Willie is grateful for small favors.
That's okay, Wheelock says at last, this time. But a new year's coming, pal. And your friend Jasper the police smurf has a piece of land in upstate New York that he wants to build a little cabana on. You capiche? The price of poker is going up.
Blind Willie says nothing, but he is listening very, very carefully now. If this were all would be well. But Wheelock's voice suggests it isn't all.
Actually, the cabana isn't the important part. Wheelock goes on. The important thing is I need a little better compensation if I have to deal with a low-life fuck like you.
Genuine anger is creeping into his voice.
How you can do this every day, even at Christmas? Man, I don't know. People who beg, that's one thing. But a guy like you, you're no more blind than I am.
Oh, you're lots blinder than me, Blind Willie thinks. But still, he holds his peace.
And you're doing okay, aren't you? Probably not as good as those PTL fucks on the tube, but you must clear, what, $1,000 a day this time of year?
$2,000? He is way low, but the miscalculation is music to Blind Willie Garfield's ears. It means that his silent partner is not watching him too closely or too frequently. Not yet, anyway. But he doesn't like the anger in Wheelock's voice. Anger is like a wild card in a poker game.
"You're no more blind than I am," Wheelock repeats. Apparently, this is the part that really gets him. "Hey, pal, you know what? I ought to follow you some night when you get off work, you know? See what you do."
He pauses. "Who you turn into?" For a moment, Blind Willie actually stops breathing. Then he starts again.
"You wouldn't want to do that, Officer Wheelock," he says.
"I wouldn't, huh? Why not, Willie? Why not? You looking out for my welfare, is that it? Afraid I might kill the shit-ass who lays the golden eggs? Hey, what I get from you in the course of a year ain't all that much when you weigh it against a commendation, maybe a promotion."
He pauses. When he speaks again, his voice has a dreamy quality which Willie finds especially alarming.
"I could be in the Post. Hero cop busts heartless scam artist on Fifth Avenue."
"Jesus," Willie thinks. "Good Jesus, he sounds serious."
"Says Garfield on your glove there, but I'd bet Garfield ain't your name. I'd bet dollars to donuts."
"That's a bet you'd lose."
"Says you, but the side of that glove looks like it's seen more than one name written there."
"It was stolen when I was a kid."
Is he talking too much?
It's hard to say.
Wheelock has managed to catch him by surprise, the bastard. First the phone rings while he's in his office, good old Ed from 9X. And now this. "The boy who stole it from me wrote his name in it while he had it. When I got it back, I erased his and put mine on again."
"And it went to Vietnam with you?"
"Yes." "It's the truth. If Sullivan had seen that battered Alvin Dark fielder's mitt, would he have recognized it as his old friend Bobby's?"
"Unlikely, but who could know?"
Sullivan never had seen it, not in the green at least, which made the whole question moot. Officer Jasper Wheelock, on the other hand, was posing all sorts of questions, and none of them were moot.
"Went to this Achu Valley with you, did it?"
Blind Willie doesn't reply. Wheelock is trying to lead him on now, and there's no place Wheelock can lead that Willie Garfield wants to go.
"Went to this tomboy place with you?"
Willie says nothing.
"Man, I thought a tomboy was a chick that liked to climb trees."
Willie continues to say nothing. "The Post," Wheelock says, and Willie dimly sees the asshole raise his hands slightly apart, as if framing a picture. "Hero cop." He might just be teasing, but Willie can't tell.
"You'd be in the Post, all right, but there wouldn't be any commendation," Blind Willie says.
"No promotion, either. In fact, you'd be out on the street, Officer Wheelock, looking for a job. You could skip applying for one with security companies, though. A man who'll take a payoff can't be bonded."
It is Wheelock's turn to stop breathing. When he starts again, the puffs of breath in Blind Willie's ear have become a hurricane. The cop's moving mouth is almost on his skin.
"What do you mean?" he whispers.
A hand settles on the arm of Blind Willie's field jacket.
"You just tell me what the fuck you mean."
But Blind Willie continues silent, hands at his sides, head slightly raised, looking attentively into the darkness that will not clear until daylight is almost gone, and on his face is that lack of expression which so many passers-by read as ruined pride, courage brought low but somehow still intact.
"Better be careful, Officer Wheelock," he thinks. "The ice under you is getting thin. I may be blind, but you must be deaf if you can't hear the sound of it cracking under your feet." The hand on his arm shakes him slightly. Wheelock's fingers are digging in.
"You got a friend? Is that it, you son of a bitch? Is that why you hold the envelope out that way half the damn time? You got a friend taking my picture? Is that it?"
Blind Willie goes on saying nothing. To Jasper the police smurf, he is now giving a sermon of silence. People like Officer Wheelock will always think the worst if you let them. You only have to give them time to do it.
"You don't want to fuck with me, pal,"
Wheelock says viciously, but there is a subtle undertone of worry in his voice, and the hand on Blind Willie's jacket loosens. We're going up to 400 a month starting in January, and if you try playing any games with me, I'm going to show you where the real playground is. You understand me? Blind Willie says nothing. The puffs of air stop hitting his ear, and he knows Wheelock is getting ready to go. But not yet, alas. The nasty little puffs come back.
You'll burn in hell for what you're doing, Wheelock tells him. He speaks with great, almost fervent sincerity. What I'm doing when I take your dirty money is a venial sin. I ask the priest, so I'm sure. But yours is mortal. You're going to hell. See how many handouts you get down there.
Blind Willie thinks of a jacket Willie and Bill Shearman sometimes see on the street. There is a map of Vietnam on the back, usually the years the wearer of the jacket spent there, and this message. When I die, I'm going straight to heaven, because I spent my time in hell. He could mention this sentiment to Officer Wheelock, but it would do no good. Silence is better. Wheelock walks away, and Willie's thought that he's glad to see him go causes a rare smile to touch his face. It comes and goes like an errant ray of sunshine on a cloudy day. 1:40 p.m. Three times he has banded the bills into rolls and dumped the change into the bottom of the case. This is really a storage function and not an effort at concealment. Now working completely by touch, he can no longer see the money, doesn't know a one from a hundred, but he senses he is having a very good day indeed. There is no pleasure in the knowledge, however. There's never much. Pleasure is not what Blind Willie is about. But even the sense of accomplishment he might have felt on another day has been muted by his conversation with Officer Wheelock. At 11:45, a young woman with a pretty voice, to Blind Willie she sounds like Diana Ross, comes out of Saks and gives him a cup of hot coffee, as she does most days at this time. At 11:15, another woman, this one not so young and probably white, brings him a cup of steaming chicken noodle soup. He thanks them both. The white lady kisses his cheek with soft lips and wishes him the merriest of Merry Christmases. There is a counterbalancing side to the day, though. There almost always is. Around 1:00, a teenage boy with his unseen gang of buddies, laughing and joking and skylarking all around him, speaks out of the darkness to Blind Willie's left, says he is one ugly motherfucker, then asks if he wears those gloves because he burned his fingers off trying to read the waffle iron. He and his friends charge off, howling with laughter at this ancient jape. 15 minutes or so later, someone kicks him, although that might have been an accident. Every time he bends over to the case, however, the case is right there. It is a city of hustlers, muggers, and thieves, but the case is right there, just as it has always been, right there. And through it all, he thinks about Wheelock. The cop before Wheelock was easy. The one who comes when Wheelock either quits the force or gets moved out of Midtown may also be easy. Wheelock will shake, bake, or flake eventually. That's something else he learned in the bush. And in the meantime, he, Blind Willie, must bend like a reed in a windstorm. Except even the limberest reed breaks if the wind blows hard enough. Wheelock wants more money, but that isn't what bothers the man in the dark glasses in the army coat. Sooner or later, they all want more money. When he started on this corner, he paid Officer Hanratty $125. Hanratty was a live-and-let-live type of guy who smelled of Old Spice and whiskey, just like George Raymer, the neighborhood beat cop of Willie Shearman's childhood. But easygoing Eric Hanratty still had Blind Willie up to $200 a month by the time he retired in 1978. And the thing is, dig it, my brothers, Wheelock was angry this morning, angry, and Wheelock talked about having consulted a priest. These things worry him, but what worries him most of all is what Wheelock said about following him. See what you do, who you turn into. Garfield ain't your name. I'd bet dollars to donuts. It's a mistake to fuck with the truly penitential, Officer Wheelock, Blind Willie thinks. You'd be safer fucking with my wife than with my name. Believe me, safer by far. Wheelock could do it, though. What could be simpler than shadowing a blind man, or even one who can see little more than shadows? Simpler than watching him turn into some hotel and enter the public men's room? Watching him go into a stall as Blind Willie Garfield and come out as Willie Shearman? Suppose Wheelock was even able to back trail him from Willie to Bill. Thinking this brings back his morning jitters, his feeling of being a snake between skins. The fear that he has been photographed taking a bribe will hold Wheelock for a while, but if he is angry enough, there is no predicting what he may do, and that is scary. God love you, soldier, says a voice out of the darkness. I wish I could do more. Not necessary, sir, Blind Willie says, but his mind is still on Jasper Wheelock, who smells of cheap cologne and talked to a priest about the blind man with the sign, the blind man who is not, in Wheelock's opinion, blind at all. What did he say? You're going to hell. See how many handouts you get down there. Have a very Merry Christmas, sir. Thank you for helping me. And the day goes on.
p.m. His sight has started to resurface, dim, distant, but there. It is his cue to pack up and go. He kneels, back ramrod stiff, and lays his cane behind the case again. He bands the last of the bills, dumps them and the last coins into the bottom of the case, then puts the baseball glove and the tinsel-decorated sign inside. He latches the case and stands up, holding his cane in the other hand. Now the case is heavy, dragging at his arm with the dead weight of all that well-meant metal. There is a heavy rattling crunch as the coins avalanche into a new position, and then they are as still as ore plugged deep in the ground. He sets off down Fifth, dangling the case at the end of his left arm like an anchor. After all these years, he's used to the weight of it, could carry it much farther than he'll need to this afternoon, if circumstances demanded. Holding the cane in his right hand and tapping it delicately on the paving in front of him, the cane is magic, opening a pocket of empty space before him on the crowded, jostling sidewalk in a teardrop-shaped wave. By the time he gets to Fifth and 43rd, he can actually see this space. He can also see the don't walk sign at 42nd stop flashing and hold solid, but he keeps walking anyway, letting a well-dressed man with long hair and gold chains reach out and grasp his shoulder to stop him.
Watch it, my man, the long hair says. Traffic's on the way.
Thank you, sir, Blind Willie says.
Don't mention it. Merry Christmas.
Blind Willie crosses, passes the lion standing sentry at the public library, and goes down two more blocks where he turns toward 6th Avenue. No one accosts him. No one has loitered, watching him collect all day long, and then followed, waiting for the opportunity to bag the case and run. Not that many thieves could run with it, not this case. Once, back in the summer of 79, two or three young guys, maybe black, he couldn't say for sure. They sounded black, but his vision had been slow returning that day. It was always slower in warm weather, when the days stayed bright longer. Had accosted him and begun talking to him in a way he didn't quite like. It wasn't like the kids this afternoon, with their jokes about reading the waffle iron and what does a Playboy centerfold look like in Braille. It was softer than that, and in some weird fashion, almost kind. Questions about how much he took in by St. Pat's back there, and would he perchance be generous enough to make a contribution to something called the Polo Recreational League,
And did he want a little protection getting to his bus stop or train station or whatever? One, perhaps a budding sexologist, had asked if he liked a little young pussy once in a while. "He'd pep you up," the voice on his left said softly, almost longingly. "Yes, sir, you must believe that shit." He had felt the way he imagined a mouse must feel when the cat is just pawing at it, claws not out yet, curious about what the mouse will do and how fast it can run and what sorts of noises it will make as its terror grows. Blind Willie had not been terrified, however. Scared, yes, indeed, you could fairly say he had been scared, but he has not been out-and-out terrified since his last week in the Green, the week that had begun in the A Shao Valley and ended in Dong Ha, the week the Viet Cong had harried them steadily west at what was not quite a full retreat, at the same time pinching them on both sides, driving them like cattle down a chute, always yelling from the trees, sometimes laughing from the jungle, sometimes shooting, sometimes screaming in the night. The little men who ain't there, Sullivan called them. There is nothing like them here, and his blindest day in Manhattan is not as dark as those nights after they lost the captain. Knowing this had been his advantage and those young fellows' mistake, he had simply raised his voice, speaking as a man might speak to a large room filled with old friends. "Say!" he had exclaimed to the shadowy phantoms drifting slowly around him on the sidewalk. "Say, does anyone see a policeman? I believe these young fellows here mean to take me off." And that did it. Easy as pulling a segment from a peeled orange, the young fellows bracketing him were suddenly gone like a cool breeze. He only wishes he could solve the problem of Officer Wheelock that easily. 4:40 p.m. The Sheraton Gotham at 40th and Broadway is one of the largest first-class hotels in the world, and in the cave of its lobby, thousands of people school back and forth beneath the gigantic chandelier. They chase their pleasures here and dig their treasures there, oblivious to the Christmas music flowing from the speakers, to the chatter from three different restaurants and five bars, to the scenic elevators sliding up and down in their notched shafts like pistons powering some exotic glass engine, and to the blind man who taps among them, working his way toward a sarcophagal public men's room almost the size of a subway station. He walks with the sticker on the case turned inward now, and he is as anonymous as a blind man can be. In this city, that's very anonymous. Still, he thinks, as he enters one of the stalls and takes off his jacket, turning it inside out as he does so, how is it that in all these years no one has ever followed me? No one has ever noticed that the blind man who goes in and the sighted man who comes out are the same size and carrying the same case? Well, in New York, hardly anyone notices anything that isn't his or her own business. In their own way, they are all as Blind Willie. Out of their offices, flooding down the sidewalks, thronging in the subway stations and cheap restaurants, there is something both repulsive and sad about them. They are like nests of moles turned up by a farmer's harrow. He has seen this blindness over and over again, and he knows that it is one reason for his success, but surely not the only reason. They are not all moles, and he has been rolling the dice for a long time now. He takes precautions, of course he does, many of them, but there are still those moments, like now, sitting here with his pants down, unscrewing the white cane and stowing it back in his case, when he would be easy to catch, easy to rob, easy to expose. Wheelock is right about the post. They would love him. They would hang him higher than Haman. They would never understand, never even want to understand, or hear his side of it. What side? And why has none of this ever happened? Because of God, he believes. Because God is good. God is hard, but God is good. He cannot bring himself to confess, but God seems to understand. Atonement and penance take time, but he has been given time. God has gone with him every step of the way. In the stall, still between identities, he closes his eyes and prays, first giving his thanks, then making a request for guidance, then giving more thanks. He finishes, as he always does, in a whisper only he and God can hear. If I die in a combat zone, bag me up and ship me home. If I die in a state of sin, close your eyes and take me in. Yeah, amen. He leaves the stall, leaves the bathroom, leaves the echoing confusion of the Sheridan Gotham, and no one walks up to him and says, "Excuse me, sir, but weren't you just blind?" No one looks at him twice as he walks out into the street, carrying the bulky case as if it weighed 20 pounds instead of 100. God takes care of him. It has started to snow. He walks slowly through it. Willie Shearman again now, switching the case frequently from hand to hand, just one more tired guy at the end of the day. He continues to think about his inexplicable success as he goes. There's a verse from the book of Matthew which he has committed to memory. "They be blind leaders of the blind," it goes, "and if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch." Then there's the old saw that says, "In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king." Is he the one-eyed man? God aside, has that been the practical secret of his success all these years? Perhaps so, perhaps not. In any case, he has been protected, and in no case does he believe he can put God aside. God is in the picture. God marked him in 1960, when he first helped Harry Doolin tease Carol and then helped Harry beat her. That occasion of sin has never left his mind. What happened in the grove of trees near Field B stands for everything else. He even has Bobby Garfield's glove to help him remember. Willie doesn't know where Bobby is these days and doesn't care. He kept track of Carol as long as he could, but Bobby doesn't matter. Bobby ceased to matter when he helped her. Willie saw him help her. He didn't dare come out and help her himself. He was afraid of what Harry might do to him, afraid of all the kids Harry might tell, afraid of being marked. But Bobby dared. Bobby helped her then. Bobby punished Harry Doolin later that summer, and by doing these things, probably just for doing the first of them, Bobby got well. Bobby got over. He did what Willie didn't dare to do. He rolled with it and got over, got well. And now Willie has to do all the rest. And that's a lot to do. Sorry is a full-time job and more. Why, even with three of him working at it, he can barely keep up. Still, he can't say he lives in regret. Sometimes he thinks of the good thief, the one who joined Christ in paradise that very night. Friday afternoon, you're bleeding on Golgotha's stony hill. Friday night, you're having tea and crumpets with the king. Sometimes someone kicks him. Sometimes someone pushes him. Sometimes he worries about being taken off. So what? Doesn't he stand for all those who can only stand in the shadows, watching while the damage is done? Doesn't he beg for them? Didn't he take Bobby's Alvin Dark model baseball glove for them in 1960? He did. God bless him, he did. And now they put their money in it as he stands eyeless outside the cathedral. He begs for them. Sharon knows. Exactly what does Sharon know? Some of it, yes. Just how much he can't say, certainly enough to provide the tinsel, enough to tell him he looks nice in his Paul Stewart suit and blue sulca tie, enough to wish him a good day and remind him to get the eggnog. It is enough. All is well in Willie's world, except for Jasper Wheelock. What is he going to do about Jasper Wheelock? "Maybe I ought to follow you some night," Wheelock whispers in his ear. as Willie shifts the increasingly heavy case from one hand to the other. Both arms ache now. He will be glad to reach his building. See what you do. See who you turn into. What exactly is he going to do about Jasper the police smurf? What can he do? He doesn't know. 5:15 p.m. The young panhandler in the dirty red sweatshirt is long gone, his place taken by yet another street corner Santa. Willie has no trouble recognizing the tubby young fellow currently dropping a dollar into Santa's pot. "Hey, Ralphie!" he cries. Ralph Williamson turns. His face lights up when he recognizes Willie, and he raises one gloved hand. It's snowing harder now. With the bright lights around him and Santa Claus beside him, Ralph looks like the central figure in a holiday greeting card, or maybe a modern-day Bob Cratchit. "Hey, Willie, how's it going?" "Like a house afire," Willie says, approaching Ralph with an easy grin on his face. He sets his case down with a grunt, feels in his pants pocket, finds a buck for Santa's pot. Probably just another crook, and his hat's a moth-eaten piece of shit. But what the hell? "What you got in there?" Ralph asks, looking down at Willie's case as he fiddles with his scarf. "Sounds like you busted open some little kid's piggy bank." "Nah, just heating coils," Willie says. "About a damn thousand of them."
"You working right up until Christmas?"
"Yeah," he says, and suddenly has a glimmer of an idea about Wheelock. Just a twinkle, here and gone, but hey, it's a start. "Yeah. Right up until Christmas. No rest for the wicked, you know." Ralph's wide and pleasant face creases in a smile. "I doubt if you're very wicked." Willie smiles back. "You don't know what evil lurks in the heart of the heating and cooling man, Ralphie. I'll probably take a few days off after Christmas, though. I'm thinking that might be a really good idea. Go south? Florida, maybe?" "South?" Willie looks startled, then laughs. "No, no," he says. "Not this kid. I've got plenty to do around the house. A person's got to keep their house in order, else it might come right down around their ears someday when the wind blows." "I suppose." Ralph bundles the scarf higher around his ears. "See you tomorrow?" "You bet," Willie says, and holds out his gloved hand. "Gimme five." Ralphie gives him five, then turns his hand over, his smile is shy but eager. "Give me 10, Willie." Willie gives him 10.
"How good is that, Ralphie, baby?"
The man's shy smile becomes a gleeful boy's grin. "So goddamn good, I gotta do it again," he cries, and slaps Willie's hand with real authority. Willie laughs.
"You the man, Ralph. You get over."
"You the man too, Willie," Ralph replies, speaking with a prissy earnestness that's sort of funny. "Merry Christmas."
"Right back at you."
He stands where he is for a moment, watching Ralph trudge off into the snow. Beside him, the street corner Santa rings his bell monotonously. Willie picks up his case and starts for the door of his building. Then something catches his eye and he pauses.
"Your beard's on crooked," he says to the Santa. "If you want people to believe in you, fix your fucking beard."
He goes inside. p.m. There's a big carton in the storage annex of Midtown Heating and Cooling. It's full of cloth bags, the sort banks use to hold loose coins. Such bags usually have various banks' names printed on them, but these don't. Willie orders them direct from the company in Moundsville, West Virginia, that makes them. He opens his case, quickly sets aside the rolls of bills. These he will carry home in his Mark Cross briefcase, then fills four bags with coins. In a far corner of the storage room is a battered old metal cabinet simply marked Parts. Willie swings it open, there is no lock to contend with, and reveals another 100 or so coin-stuffed bags. A dozen times a year, he and Sharon tour the Midtown churches, pushing these bags through the contribution slots or hinged package delivery doors when they will fit, simply leaving them by the door when they won't. The lion's share always goes to St. Pat's, where he spends his days wearing dark glasses and a sign. But not every day, he thinks, now undressing. I don't have to be there every day. And he thinks again that maybe Bill, Willie, and Blind Willie Garfield will take the week after Christmas off. In that week, there might be a way to handle Officer Wheelock, to make him go away. Except, I can't kill him, he says in a low, nagging voice. I'll be fucked if I kill him. Only, fucked isn't what he's worried about. Damned is what he's worried about. Killing was different in Vietnam, or seemed different. But this isn't Vietnam, isn't the green. Has he built these years of penance just to tear them down again? God is testing him, testing him, testing him. There is an answer here. He knows there is. There must be. He is just, ha-ha, pardon the pun, too blind to see it. Can he even find the self-righteous son of a bitch? Shit, yeah, that's not the problem. He can find Jasper the police smurf, all right, just about any old time he wants. Trail him right to wherever it is that he takes off his gun and his shoes and puts his feet up on the hassock. But then what? He worries at this, as he uses cold cream to remove his makeup, and then he puts his worries away. He takes the November through December ledger out of its drawer, sits at his desk, and for 20 minutes he writes, "I am heartily sorry for hurting Carol." He fills an entire page, top to bottom and margin to margin. He puts it back, then dresses in Bill Shearman's clothes. As he is putting away Blind Willie's boots, his eye falls on the scrapbook with its red leather cover. He takes it out, puts it on top of the file cabinet, and flips back the cover with its single word, "Memories," stamped in gold. On the first page is the certificate of a live birth, William Robert Shearman, born January 4, 1946, and his tiny footprints. On the following pages are pictures of him with his mother, pictures of him with his father, Pat Shearman smiling as if he had never pushed his son over in his high chair or hit his wife with a beer bottle. Pictures of him with his friends. Harry Doolin is particularly well represented. In one snapshot, 8-year-old Harry is trying to eat a piece of Willie's birthday cake with a blindfold on, a forfeit in some game, no doubt. Harry's got chocolate smeared all over his cheeks. He's laughing and looks as if he doesn't have a mean thought in his head. Willie shivers at the sight of that laughing, smeary, blindfolded face. It almost always makes him shiver. He flips away from it, toward the back of the book, where he's put the pictures and clippings of Carol Gerber he has collected over the years. Carol with her mother. Carol holding her brand new baby brother and smiling nervously. Carol and her father, him in navy dress blue and smoking a cigarette, her looking up at him with big wonderstruck eyes. Carol on the JV cheering squad at Harwich High her freshman year, caught in mid-leap with one hand waving a pom-pom and the other holding down her pleated skirt. Carol and John Sullivan on tinfoil thrones at Harwich.